Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
Mike, it is fun when wrestlers know whether fans like them or not and lean in on those emotions. Sammy Guevara and Ty Conti going all in as heels by simply just leaning in a little harder on the traits that cause fans to turn against them in the first place. Fun match. It'll be nice when they get aligned with full-fledged heels. Not quite sure what's going on with Lambert, Sky, and Paige right now because they're certainly better as heels than faces. But Sky beating Sammy Guevara, and I think a bit of a surprise. Sammy moving on now without the TNT title, presumably, as a emerging fresh heel act with Ty Conti. Your thoughts on the main event?
Yeah, I liked it. I did. And I wonder, like, they've flipped this TNT title a couple of times now recently, and I think if you're doing that with a mid-card title, especially, it's fine. I mean, once in a while, you see titles move around. It's not like one guy's going to hold it for a year all the time. So I wonder, too, how much of this movement came about because of the reaction they were getting. And it's just my guess. We don't know. But, you know, I wonder if Tony had different plans for them, and they obviously started to get a little bit of a different reaction, and then plans may have changed. I'm not sure. But, I mean, I know it's also kind of been out there for a while, too, that Scorpio Sky was somebody they wanted to invest in 2022, and it seems like they're now, you know, very much moving in that direction.
I think Sky has earned being a champion for more than just a transition type reign, and I think Dan Lambert and Ethan Page are, and all three of them together are a good act and have good chemistry. So yeah, let's do more with them. I'm more forgiving. I think there should be rapid fire title changes occasionally, because it is kind of silly if every title reign is really long and it's the changing of an era. It's the signal of major change, and there's someone who's new and dominant. I like that kind of title reign. I've been an advocate for long title reigns for decades when they used to do rapid fire changes too often. But that said, it's not realistic that there'll always be dynasties. And so that's storyline wise, I'm for it. And I also think they're just for extenuating circumstances, not to explain every TNT title change, but you have Sammy with the crowd reacting differently in an audible being called with his and Conti's character. You had stuff going on with Cody that I think kind of changed the direction of where they were going. And so I'm sort of like, hopefully Sky gets the rain for a while now. You know, I mean, I'm ready to settle in, or if there's just some reason they have one particular final transition, if it's not Sky, the next person, hold it for 3-4 months. You know, the thing about the TNT title, too, is it's defended more often. That tradition is established now more often than the AEW World Heavyweight title. So by definition, there ought to be more title changes. So I'm okay with that, too. Don't overdo it. Don't do this perpetually and continually. But at this point, you know, I'm not too down on them, but I would just say, okay, I don't want to say enough is enough, because that's sort of judging what they've done. And again, like I said, I think there's some asterisks in terms of what caused some of these changes. But I think a little stability would be good for a while now, Mike.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think you go back and forth, right? I mean, 20 years ago when rapid fire title changes were all that was happening, it was too much. And we were looking for a long-term champion because it was something different. Now, where we've seen long-term champions, whether it's Punk in WWE or Reigns now, or Omega held the belt for quite a long time in AEW. Like, it's good to have something different pop up every once in a while. It keeps things fresh and just keeps things real. I mean, I always, when Andrew Socek and I talk on our show, I always compare things like, well, could this feasibly happen in real life? You know, could this feasibly in the UFC, which is kind of the closest thing to pro wrestling that is an actual fight? You know, could this happen? Could you have a champion who wins a title and then the champion he won it from gets an automatic rematch, and that champion wins it back, and then the other person wins it back again? Like, yeah, That could happen. It's happened before. That could conceivably happen in actual sports. So every once in a while to work that into your show is absolutely fine. I think if you do it too much, then all of a sudden people are growing tired of it, just as the same as if, you know, you have one-year-long champions all the time. At some point, people are going to grow tired of it. So I think it's good. I think it keeps it fresh. I think it keeps people, the viewers, on their toes, and to know that, okay, just because, you know, whether it's the TNT title or even the world title down the line, just because so-and-so just won this belt, it doesn't necessarily mean that I don't have to pay attention to their first three title defenses because they might not lose it. You've now had the precedent set that, yeah, you know what, somebody can lose the belt in their first title defense.
Totally agree. And I think that's a good point, too. You know, it's sort of like having every once in a while a three count early in a match that you fully expect to go 10 minutes. It conditions the crowd, the larger fan base, to say, I got to be on my toes the whole time. You know, it's why overtime in the NHL is more exciting than the first period, because the game can yeah. end any time. And so there is that. Also, there's the issue of just in terms of this main event match quality. And this was a bit of a undisciplined, lack of selling, self-indulgent spot fest that when you're critical of it, you look like a fool because the crowd ate it up so much. That said, when Sammy got knocked off, I mean, we can pick on a number of things here, but this is a trait in Sammy matches. So I'm going to pick, I love his character. I thought he was great with Jericho. I thought he was an oblivious, awful baby face. And I want to give him a ton of credit for understanding he's insufferable and unself-aware and obnoxious, and go with it. And he is, I'm not saying as a real person, I'm just saying as a performer, he knows he and Tony, there's no fighting it like there was with Cody and Tony. So I love that he just went with it. And he might, you know, this isn't about who he is as a real person, just as a performer, he was pretty tone deaf as a baby face. He's in the right spot now. But he does this in his matches. So as a worker, I am critical of him for too often having a big spot late in the match that he doesn't sell. And that happened here, you know, that bump onto the barbed wire ladder. And then next thing you know, he's off camera. They're focused on Scott. Next thing you know, he's springboarding from the middle rope onto the ladder. And it's like, dude, you just took this gigantic bump. That's even setting aside the bump before the break, that twisting corkscrew that completely missed Sky, and looked like it could have gone, you know, wrong. And, you know, Sammy's just been like, you know, I don't know what word to use to push back against people saying he's, you know, taking unnecessary risks early in his career. I always remember, you know, I mean, you hear stories from so many veterans, but the Terry Taylor one sticks out. You know, I just heard Terry just would tell wrestlers, and this was like 15 years ago when he first was, you know, agenting. And he's like, you're not going to believe me, because I didn't believe the veterans telling me when I was in my 20s to be careful. And I certainly was way more careful than you guys are. Every generation goes through this, but it's my duty to tell you, you're going to regret these unnecessary bumps that are not an essential part of telling the story or getting fans invested in your match. You're showing off and you're putting your body at risk, and you're going to pay the price in 15 years. I've done my job. Now go be a young fool. And that's kind of what Sammy's doing. If it was necessary and helped him earn money and made the ratings better and got him over and his opponents over, okay, there's sacrifice that comes with being a wrestler. But some of the stuff he's doing either doesn't make sense or is extra dangerous. And like that ladder spot, it didn't even look good because it was a lot of twisting and flipping, but he missed. So that kind of thing I'm going to be critical of, even if the crowd is quite forgiving, you know, live when they see this kind of thing. Mike, your thoughts?
I absolutely agree. And there was a couple in there that looked close to just at the speed at which they were pulling off some of those spots. There was one about halfway through the match. I could be wrong. I think I think Sky gave him a DDT, but Sammy kind of almost speared him as he took the move. And it looked like he spiked his head right off the mat. And even that made me go, oh, because they're moving at such a fast pace. And obviously when you're doing that, like you said, they're not selling the move. So therefore, not only do they kind of mean less and less, well, it also means that if you're moving at such a fast pace and you're not selling any of those big moves, then what's happening? You're taking more of them because you're moving at a fast pace and you're not selling anything. So it adds up and it adds up and it adds up. Matches like this, I'm sure, are taxing. I think it helps that they only have one show a week at most he's doing this once a week. You know what I mean? And it's not like he's going to end up working four times over the weekend and stuff like that. So that will help, I think. But still, you're playing with fire, I think, with some of these more dangerous spots. And like you said, the thing that concerns me is if you're pulling off all these big moves, but you're not giving them any time to breathe, and you're not selling any of them.
Yeah.
They're going to start to mean less and less and less. And I think we're already there. Like, they're already starting to mean less and less. And that's going to be a problem moving forward for not only Sammy, but the rest of the roster.
This is not against high spots. It's not against big spots. It's about doing high spots and big spots that are going to take a toll on your body in a way that minimizes risk, maximizes excitement, and means the most in some semblance of a logical context. And frankly, some of that was missing in this match. So anyway, point made. Ross saying keep your tongues under control, kids, was just tremendous. Sam Conti is a great heel. Todd Martin and I talked about on the Fix last week. Like, I want Ty to not lean into like being a heel, but to be a little more oblivious to why people are booing them. Like, I like that side of her better, the authentic versus the now I'm a heel, so I'm gonna just act like a heel. I kind of like the idea of her acting like she doesn't understand why their get a room overt affection for each other is turning people off, because we're so beautiful. Why wouldn't you want to watch us, you know, love in motion? But overall they're well cast, and Sammy and Conti are ready to draw ratings and make money. And most importantly, go against a babyface who's going to benefit from the real genuine heat that fans, feel towards them.
Yeah, I mean, I made a comparison tonight. It almost feels like they could move in a direction of keeping Sammy and Ty kind of where Cody and Brandy were.
Yeah.
Only Cody and Brandy were still – I mean, they were still trying to be baby faces, but, you know, in Sammy and Ty's case, you could have them kind of play up. Why are you booing us? Like, we're the good people here in playing that role. I think that works, and it kind of slides them right into that same role, only now they're working it instead of having – people just pushing back against what they're doing.
Exactly. All right, well, let's pause and introduce the show, and then we'll get to phone calls, emails, and all that good stuff, and more topics, of course, coming out of tonight's episode of Dynamite, including Dax versus Cash. We got a good old fireball angle and Owen Hart tournament developments and more. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, April 27th, 2022. I am Wade Keller, a 30-plus year veteran full-time reporter covering professional wrestling, who launched the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter back before people owned computers. Scientists did, but just people didn't. Used my grandma's old typewriter to type up the first issue when I was in high school, and have been doing this through college and ever since, and it continues to be a blast. So thanks to everybody for supporting me and the whole team for this long so we can continue to do it. And we are here covering AEW Dynamite, as we do every Wednesday night. My co-host is Mike McMahon, a longtime PW Torch contributor, both in terms of in the form of written reports on our website and also podcasting. He and Andrew Socek currently cover AEW every week on the PW Torch Daily Cast lineup. That is a free lineup of shows, a different show each day of the week, a different theme to each of the shows each day of the week, including shows covering ROH, soon to shift to covering the larger indie scene with the changes in ROH, AEW, NXT, and more, including, by the way, the newest part of the lineup, the PW Torch 90s Past Cast. And by the way, Patrick and Alex, who host that, are going to be hosting the SmackDown Post Show this Friday, a rare show where we won't be taking live calls because I will be at the Minnesota Timberwolves Memphis Grizzlies Game 6. Timberwolves don't make the playoffs often enough in my time following them to miss out on a chance to go to a live game. I missed out on Saturday because I had an emergency vet visit for my dog, who is doing well. We're still waiting some important test results, but he's back on his feet and doing well. But I two tickets went on you Saturday, so I am going Friday, and so we're going to kind of change the format up. It's going to be fun because Alex loves and follows WWE, and Patrick doesn't. He doesn't watch it. So he's going to watch it instead of covering Rampage on Friday. He and Alex are going to compare notes. And so Alex is going to have to defend SmackDown as Patrick says, how can you like this stuff? How can you watch it? Someday we got to flip it around because Alex doesn't like AEW and Patrick does. So it's fun dynamic to have them cover current stuff, but on the PW Torch Daily Cast lineup, they cover they go back 30 years to the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter 30 years ago this week and analyze it and react to it, and that's part of the PW Torch Daily Cast lineup also. So search PW Torch on your podcast app. Don't miss out on a real talented podcast host, each show with its own kind of niche theme and topic. Mike McMahon, welcome back to the co-host chair.
Yeah, thanks. It's been a while. I know the last time we did this, it was right when my schedule changed and Wednesdays didn't work enough for Andrew and I anymore. That's when we usually record it. So we moved to Tuesdays. So it's still all the after show, but it's kind of the before show. It's although it's after, we joke that it's after Rampage from the previous week. So that's why we kept the name the same. But a rare Wednesday off for me, which has given me the opportunity to join you. So this is good.
Yeah, I'm glad it worked out. So it's a fun week here having you as an infrequent co-host and then Patrick Moynihan and Alex McDonald on Friday covering SmackDown. And I had a fun show with Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Rich Fan 2 nights ago. He joined me on the Raw post show. We went 2 hours talking Raw and a few sidebars as occurs with Rich and me when we do shows together. But we had an on-site correspondent, lots of good calls and emails, and a good conversation about Raw and broader WWE. Cool. Oh, and yesterday, Jason Powell joined me on the flagship edition of our blue logo show. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling post show with the red logo. Our other podcast feed that's free is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling podcast feed with the blue logo. Jason joined me. We talked close to 2 hours about a wide array of topics. We did get one thing wrong. I want to do a quick correction on. We talked about how Roman Reigns, we're wondering if Roman Reigns was really injured because they hadn't announced a match for Backlash. And it just slipped my mind. Reigns has actually done house show matches, including like long matches against Drew McIntyre at house shows. So he is active. I did do some follow-up today because I hadn't asked him in a couple weeks about his status, and word is he's fine. You know, I mean, it looks like he's fine. So I think it's just a choice to not have him on Backlash. But Jason and I just slipped up in reacting to, I think, an email or whatever it was when we were still wondering if Reigns was inactive due to an injury. So I wanted to get that correction out there and make it clear he's healthy. It's a choice by WWE, and I take the blame for being a couple weeks behind on my take on that. Mike, how about we give out phone numbers and discuss Dynamite some more, and then a little bit later in the show we'll talk more about how people can hear you talk AEW every week. Our phone number is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. When you call push 1 on your keypad, that'll flag you on our switchboard and indicate you want to be on the show with us. You can also email us if that's easier for you. The email is wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. Either way works great for us. So consider yourself invited to either call now or email. And you can do the same for SmackDown on Friday. We won't be taking calls, but the inbox will be open, and I'll be sure Patrick and Alex get your emails, unless I'm just passed out from stress during the Memphis Timberwolves. I'm recovered from the dramatic comeback loss last night, but not entirely. But it's been fun. Playoff basketball is fun. I wish we had it more often here, but hopefully with this team, we'll get it more often, Mike.
I was going to say, we've been a little spoiled, although not so much with the Celtics, but in the Boston area, we've obviously been a little spoiled. But it was very fun as a Celtics fan watching them sweep Kyrie and the Nets in the first round.
Oh, yes.
I was very pleased that of all teams to match up with in the first round, you get the Nets, and it's like, geez, are they really a 7 seed? Come on. I mean, just because most of their guys were hurt or unable to play all year, and then to sweep Kyrie out of the playoffs felt extra nice, that's for sure.
Yes, and when you say you haven't been spoiled, I know it seems like a while for you, but you did get Kevin Garnett, you know, who brought us to the playoffs year after year after year, but never passed the first round except for once. You get him, and you guys win a title with our guy, who at least said, you know, shouted out to Soda in his, you know, post-victory and said, this is for us, too. That's the closest we've come by far to an NBA title with Kevin Garnett giving Minnesota a shout-out. So you're not spoiled like Red Sox and Patriots. And the Bruins aren't exactly spoiling you, but
anyway. No, they've had one.
Yes, which is one more than the Wild in their 22 years, but yeah. maybe this year.
But all right. Yeah, I think the six for the Patriots, whatever it is now at this point, it probably makes it up for it.
Yeah, just and then Vikings. When I was like a tiny little kid, Fran Tarkenton was taking the Vikings to the Super Bowl only to lose, and you know, so I haven't had a Super Bowl memory since then. Anyway, all right.
I keep telling my kids, I'm like, don't get used to this, boys. Like, they're both younger. I go, this is not how it always was. Believe me, when I was your age, we were depressed and nobody won anything here. So stop thinking this happens all the time.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, good advice. Good advice. All right. Like I said, there's so much more to talk about. On Mike, did you think this was good Dynamite? Just a short answer, you know, kind of short answer on this one. Is a good episode of Dynamite? Average? What was your overall take? And then we'll go to our first call.
I liked it. Yeah, overall, I thought it was a pretty good episode. I thought the opener was great, and I thought the Punk promo was good. I mean, they probably had to make some caveats there with Hangman being off the show. I'm sure the plan wasn't just Punk cuts the promo, but for what they did, it was good. I thought it filled in just fine for a week. And main event, there were some issues with it, but overall, pretty good. Yeah, I would say a pretty solid show overall.
Yeah, I think so, too. If this was a show where they cut out a segment that was planned and they just spread everything else out a little bit, I'm okay with that. But yeah. I thought there was a joy of performance with a lot of what went on tonight. A lot of good athleticism, again, not all prudent and judicious, but good athleticism. And sometimes you can sit through 2 or 3 hours of WWE and not see that enough of that. So, you know, that's very good. And this felt like personalities were aligned. You know, they've got the Blackpool Combat Club lined up as I think baby faces, you know, that we're not have them attacking poor, they're not attacking wrestlers with their back turned before the bell. You know, and I had an issue with that early with them. If they were not going to be full fledged heels, but the crowd loves them. Regal's great. They got them aligned. They got Sammy aligned. Right. Menard and what's the other guy? The former 2.0. I still haven't, can't roll their names off my tongue, but they are.
Yeah.
I am fans of them in this role as just, you know, lackey sidekick Big Mouse who just want to see get their ass kicked. And Kingston doing great stuff on the mic. You know, more of those cast well. MJF is out there getting a little dose of mic time here and there, not just these epic long promos, which I think is good to sprinkle in to shake things up. On and on, yeah, this was a well-formatted, well-paced, largely well-paced show that, you know, you just sit back for 2 hours and have fun. Not that there aren't things to critique, and we will do that as Mike, you do, and I do with this brand. We are not apologists or fanboys when it comes to our coverage of it, but certainly there's a lot to appreciate, and we do that too. All right, so let's get rolling on calls. We'll begin with Ashley in Virginia. Ashley, thanks for calling again. Good to hear from you. What do you think of Dynamite tonight?
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call, Wade. How are you? And Mike, how are you doing? Before I go on, I'm so happy to be able to call in tonight and talk to you. Mike, you're one of my favorite hosts on the PW Torch lineup here, so it's cool to talk to you as well. So thank you, guys.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
But I didn't wait. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I had a call to action last week. So if I'm not the correct Ashley, I apologize, but I was going to call in last Friday, but I missed Mike. So, okay, cool. So I was going to try to make it a point tonight. But to get to the show, and I'm sorry I missed the first part of y'all's intro here, but I kind of wanted to touch on two things really quick. First, what you both think the actual story for CM Punk and Paige leading up to the match will be. Do you think Punk will kind of, like, call back to his Straight Edge Society days and kind of play on, like, Hangman's drinking or anything like that? I know that's not, like, a main focus point for Paige anymore or as it used to be in the past, or just what you guys think the actual story will be. And just your quick thoughts on Jeff Hardy's debut singles match, just kind of being, like, thrown out there next week against Bobby Fish. Me, personally, like, Jeff has always been, like, a big favorite of mine growing up, so maybe I'm a little biased, but I just kind of expected a little bit more hype into his, like, debut singles match, or just maybe a little bit more of, like, a substantial feud. I do like that it's for in the tournament, at least, but just kind of your guys' thoughts on that.
Two good questions. Mike, take either of them first, and then I'll respond to it.
Yeah, it's a really good point on the punk question. I don't know how they're going to play that out. I mean, it seems like, at least at the promo tonight, it was more of a, hey, I have, you know, mutual respect, but when we get in the ring, there's going to be a fight. They're going to have to build some animosity there, obviously, before the match, and it'll be interesting to see what they choose to use, but that is, I had not actually thought of that, of bringing up Hangman, you know, brings the beer to the ring and stuff like that. I mean, that would be an interesting way to approach it. I don't know. The thing, though, is would be what it would do to Punk. Would it turn him heel at all? Which it could. I mean, people could revolt against it. Obviously, he was largely a heel when he did that in the first place. So that would be interesting. I don't know how they will tell that story, but it's a good point.
I hope they don't do that. Honestly, like I think I didn't like the straight edge thing being used against Punk. It's such a sensitive issue, especially with Moxley part of the company and what he went through. And
yeah,
I don't think Punk, and I just don't think people want to cheer or boo an angle that I think has affected all of us. I mean, like anybody with any kind of size, you know, size family or group of friends or, you know, friends. I mean, we just, such a large majority of people have been around it. And I think people watch wrestling to escape, and it just doesn't fit Punk or Hangman to be the type of person who would taunt the other. I would like to, my preference would be keep Straight Edge out and keep Hangman Page's drinking out of this. And I think there's a number of other angles that can be taken. And I haven't put a ton of thought into it, but Hangman is young. He's in his 20s. Punk is in his 40s. And I think Punk approached becoming a star and becoming a factor in wrestling in a different way than Hangman Page did. And I think there's a way to talk about their similarities and their differences in terms of their paths and their personalities and pull from legit history. And, you know, it's kind of the verbal equivalent of what happened with Dax and Cash, where there was this palm face pushback by Dax that, and we'll talk about this, that Cash interpreted as an intentional eye poke. So was it or wasn't it? Was it a flagrant foul, to use an NBA term, or inadvertent and not excessive? There was an honest disagreement between two guys who are going to be teaming up next week probably. Let Punk and Hangman have that kind of misunderstanding or someone overreact or react to something that they think was personal when the other person plausibly did not mean it to be personal. Let things get heated up. And go with that. I'm looking forward to this. I know Hangman Page announced he tested positive for COVID, so he wouldn't be here this week. I thought it was fine, though. I like Punk doing the solo, straightforward promo, saying, I didn't know if I was ready. Now I know I am. It gives Hangman something to respond to next week. I liked what they did this week, and I'd say keep it kind of simple. Ashley, back to you if you want to respond to that, and then we'll talk about Jeff.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you guys, and I really like how you touched on the whole point with Moxley, and I think with AEW just kind of being the company that they are, I think that's a good point. I don't think that they'll kind of touch on that, at least in that regard. Yeah, I was just trying to get your early thoughts on that and where you see that direction going.
Yeah. As far as Jeff Hardy goes, this gets to a larger issue, Mike, with AEW and the shiny new toys. They've benefited from so many of names becoming available that were just too hard to turn down. You know, I mean, Andrade, Samoa Joe, Miro, on and on. I mean, we could list all of them. But they come so rapidly, there hasn't been a time to just let it take us on a journey where that person is – where some of them have, but most of them haven't been a consistent focus all along. Like Christian got a little push at the beginning and now is kind of blended in the background. Others just disappear for weeks at a time. To me, Jeff Hardy is somebody, if you do it right – the fan base is showing they're really into the Hardys, and they can turn Jeff Hardy into somebody that I think they can put in any level of singles match in AEW if they tell that story in front of their largest audience on Dynamite. But part of it seeming like he's not on a nostalgia tour or on his last legs is by making sure that you make a big deal out of everything that he does. And AEW loses focus sometimes because they have a wealth of things that they can focus on any given week and a lot of wrestlers chiming in with good ideas. And Tony Khan is, frankly, probably understaffed when it comes to just kind of keeping track of that big picture. And his personality is such where I think he's more for rapid fire, go, 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 instead of let's step back and be a little more patient and focused even at the exclusion of some other people at that time. So to me, I get what Ashley's saying. Make a big deal out of Jeff Hardy. Maybe they can start that next week, but this is typical of them. I mean, it's the Excalibur rapid fire, you know, six pieces of news thrown at us rapid fire fashion as they frenetically go to a break before the main event starts. Mike, your thoughts on any of that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I also wouldn't – I mean, if it were me, I wouldn't even have Jeff wrestling as a singles right now. I think where they really could make some headway with him, and what people really want to see since he first joined the company, was what the Hardys were going to do as a team. And there's a lot of matches there for the Hardys to explore as a team, whether it's the Bucks, FTR, Jurassic Express at some point. I mean, there's a lot of matches for them to have, pay-per-view quality matches or Dynamite main event quality matches for them as a tag team. And then I still think you have time. I mean, Jeff isn't a young guy, but you could have them kind of play around as a team for 6 to 8 months, and there's still plenty of time after that to then use Jeff in a top singles role as well. And it may give you more time to introduce him a little bit more as a singles guy, even though everybody knows who he is. But still, I think the excitement was the number of tag teams that AEW has, and the fact that even when the Hardys were together as a team, they haven't really been in a company for a while where the tag team division was very deep and they had a lot of different teams that they could work with, and they finally have that now. So I feel like the bigger money in Jeff, at least here in the immediate future, right away as he first joined the company, is probably just to keep him as a tag and not even explore the single stuff until you've exhausted all the tag team stuff with him and Matt.
I think that's a good point, too. I mean, if you're going to do singles, do it right, make it count, be consistent, build to something big. But why not save that until you get some, so-called dream matches with the Hardys, novel matches with the Hardys. And you can do that for 6 months or 9 months before. And if you keep the Hardys looking strong, obviously Jeff is in better physical shape compared to his prime than Matt, who's just, you know, showing more wear and tear. But if Matt's broken down, you know, if Matt can't go and it's too tough, I mean, yes, you can have Jeff carry the load, but maybe you just, you know, maybe they just feel, well, we should shift to singles matches sooner if that ends up being the case too. Ashley, anything else you want to say?
No, that was it, guys. Again, thank you so much for taking my call. I appreciate it. And it's always fun to talk to you guys.
I appreciate you chiming in and calling. Please call again.
Absolutely. Will do. Take care.
Excellent. That is a call out to people who listen but don't push one, or listen on delay and aren't able to join us live. When you are able to join us live, please do and give us a call. We'd love to hear from people who are regular listeners who aren't necessarily able, scheduling-wise, to call all the time. Just call when you can. And it's great to also hear from female voices in the mix. We know you're out. We're pretty sure you're out there based on our demographic statistics that we get. And we'd love to hear from everybody, including our female listeners. Mike, she mentioned your show. So let's just take a moment to expand on that a little bit. Talk about what you and Andrew do in your format and how it's different than what we do here on the Wake Up Pro Wrestling post show after Dynamite.
Sure. So Andrew and I record on Tuesdays, and the show's usually out late Tuesday night or first thing Wednesday morning, as Wade said in the Daily Cast lineup. We talk mostly about AEW. We still talk about what happens on Dynamite and on Rampage, and we talk about the booking and the story ideas and how things are progressing on the show. We also tend to talk about some bigger picture stuff as well, maybe more of the business decisions, some of the bigger picture stuff than just necessarily reacting to what happened on the show that week. We still obviously talk about what happens on the show, but we talk about some of the bigger picture stuff as well. And every once in a while we get off topic and we go on tangents, and that has been pretty common with us, but it's fun. And yeah, you can listen, like I said, usually late Tuesday nights, early Wednesday mornings, depending upon where you are. And the Daily Cast lineup, you can email us at alltheleadaftershow@gmail.com. We make it a point to answer all those every week on the show. So that's what we do. That's what we do. We record every Tuesday. So usually we get a lot of people now that kind of know our schedule. And you know, sometime around 7 or 8 p.m. on Tuesday nights, we get emails. In fact, this week we had a couple that floated in as we were recording. I was like, it's almost like we're reacting live to people here.
That's awesome. All right, cool. So again, search PW Torch on your podcast app. You can see the PW Torch Daily Cast lineup at pwtorchdailycast.com. To join us live, I mentioned that a minute ago, you can always go to my reports at pwtorch.com. In my Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown reports, there is a link to our live stream, also the phone numbers and emails. And you can also look on our Twitter account at PW Torch. Near the end of the show, I put out a live link. And You can also go to WadeKellerPostShow.com and find the link to the live stream. So lots of ways to join us live after the three live primetime shows go off the air. All right, we'll go next to Scott in Tampa, Florida. Scott, thanks for calling. Good to hear from you. What'd you think of Dynamite tonight?
Dynamite was okay. I want to give you flowers, Wade, for your show yesterday with on the flagship with Jason. You guys hit it out the park. A lot of topics, sitting here nodding my head to. But it was mainly on AEW's rapid pacing and not following through on storylines, but not following through on new debuts and there's always new news and things that flows from segment to segment and just rapid news and future matches that's announced like Excalibur. Just a lot of disjointed mess that usually goes on. But tonight was okay. I felt it was a little paced much better than it had been in weeks before. They actually promoted the main event tonight, which is another thing that you've criticized them for and that I've agreed with. They don't hype up their main events, especially with title matches. So I was kind of relieved, and it was a good thing to actually see a promo by Scorpio Sky and a promo by Sammy, regardless of how short it was, and it was pre-taped, but at least it was something. So what do you think of that? The overall, I know you guys talked about the pacing of the show, but the fact that they've actually promoted their main event tonight, like, and even how subtle it may have been.
That's one of the reasons I like this show. It's those little details that add up and make me feel like they're getting the most out of what they're putting on TV. It's not about spending a ton of time with a long in-ring promo, belaboring points. But when you have a TV main event, I want to hear from those wrestlers. I want to be reminded how I'm supposed to feel and what's at stake. And just be reminded, other than Excalibur or Ross or Shivani saying it during a match or going into a break, make it feel important enough that we need to hear from those people. And they did that tonight. And Mike, as Jason Paul and I talked about yesterday, and I know some people, don't like too much of a focus because they love AEW. It's like me with my local sports teams. You don't want to hear people just go, it's not like we're saying you shouldn't be a fan because these people's personalities are awful and they're not good people and they're not honorable players. Like, it's not like that. It's like the criticism of AEW is, we love pro wrestling. We wouldn't be doing this for decades if we didn't, but we have watched enough and our approach to how we cover it is such where we want to see them get the most out of what they do, the most out of the wrestlers' efforts, and get people the most excited and invested in what's going to be presented on TV. And AEW isn't great at that. That's a shortcoming. There's many strengths, but that is a shortcoming. And today I thought they shored it up. They don't always fail to promote the main event, but it just should be a given. And it was so easy, and it made me more invested in the main event, being reminded of it during the show and hearing from the wrestlers who were going to be in it by the time ring entrances took place. And this literally has happened to me. An hour, 40 minutes into the show, sometimes I'm like, I have no idea what the main event is, even though I was thinking about it earlier in the day. I'm wrapped up in everything else that has happened, and the ring entrance starts, and I go, oh, that's right, that's the main event. And I have to then reorient myself towards my emotions and how I'm going to feel about it. I shouldn't have, you want people anticipating that main event. And so they did a good job. So anyway, Mike, your thoughts on that.
I'd like to see them get back to, and they did this a little bit at the very beginning, and they've kind of stopped. Every once in a while they'll do it. But I'd like to see them get back to announcing the main events a week ahead of time.
Yeah.
So tonight, they tell us tonight, next week, you don't have to tell us the whole card. Because, I get it. Things change. You might not know the whole card week to week. But if you have your main event booked for the following week and you announce it on the show, it gives you a week of being able to plug that on social media. It gives you the ability to plug it on Rampage and so on and so on. And that should help kind of cement that a little bit. And I agree. I think it's – people are going to get sick of me going back to the same comparison over and over again. But you watch a UFC show, and they're not necessarily always telling you about things that are 3 months down the line, even though, in their business, things are booked several weeks in advance, if not months in advance. But you and now UFC is pretty much every Saturday. It's very rare that they have a Saturday night off, whether it's on ESPN or pay-per-view. You can watch a show on ESPN on a Saturday night, and they're telling you what the main event is the next week. They're talking about it because it's already booked and they know about it. And they may even air a video package on here's what the main event is next week. These two guys are fighting, or these two girls are fighting for a featherweight title or whatever it is. It sets up the next week's show. So I'd like to see them even go far as to going back to that. They've done it a couple of times, especially early on. It was almost a weekly thing, I feel like, where they were really pushing the next week's main event on this week's show. I'd like to see them get back to that.
All right, Scott, back to you.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. Like you said, Wade, just by them announcing it during the show and hearing the promos, like, I remember exactly what the main event was. Like, when the Undisputed Elite match was taking place, I'm like, it's not the main event. You know, I looked at the time. I'm like, oh, yeah, I know what the main event is tonight. It's Scorpio Sky and Sammy. So just, yeah, those little things, just announcing it, making it feel important, it means a lot. It goes a long way. Even though the match wasn't great, I didn't really care, honestly, because I was already invested in the story and the outcome. So everything they did in between really didn't matter to me that much. It's simply because they hyped it tonight and gave it a little bit of attention. My second point I want to bring up is about the Jericho Appreciation Society. And that's one that I would disagree with you, Wade, on. I don't like it. Like, it's not hidden for me. I don't know if it's the pieces that I don't mix, or maybe just the story with Eddie and Santana and Ortiz. It feels like it's been dragging for months, at least to me. I kind of am waiting for this to be over. I hope, Double or Nothing, they have a blow-off match, and, then they can move on. So, but I guess my main point to you is, what other story could they, that faction get into, and what other feuds they can possibly have after this one? Like, I'm not sure. I'm not quite sure if this sports entertainer's gimmick for this group is gonna last. Like, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it. Like, so what? Is there any, what's the next hope, pretty much, I guess, is the question for them.
The next hope for what? I'm sorry.
The next story and the next feud for Jericho Appreciation Society.
Gotcha, yeah. Mike, I want to throw to you, because I am curious, too, what you think of the group as a whole, and also what the former 2.0 are adding to it. In terms of, the chemistry that they have with Jericho and the heat as heels that they're getting.
The group I like. I mean, just the pairing of those guys together I like. I think that they work. I think the personalities mix. I like that, 2.0 being added to them is giving them somewhere on the show to be featured with a main event level guy, and I think that is going to rub off. I'm not totally sold on what they're doing and going heavy into the, Jericho's sports entertainment appreciation stuff, only because, as the caller said, I don't know where you go from there. Even if they end up coming out on top in this feud and they end up getting the better of Eddie Kingston and Santana and Ortiz, what's next? What's the next story? Are they doing the same thing again where now they're going to feud with, Pentagon and Phoenix, and it's going to be about how they think sports entertainment is better than Lucha Libre? Like, what are they just going to do the same thing over and over? I don't know where you go from here. You almost have to completely change what that group is about. Like, if their core value is just, we're appreciating Chris Jericho in the sports entertainment side of what wrestling is, I don't know. You almost have to change their entire identity to do something different with them.
Well, part of my joy is just making fun of something that on national television that, we've been making fun of for however long, which is, if you could build a sports entertainer from the ground up, he'd look like Randy Orton, in WWE Universe. And now we have AEW Galaxy. It's hard to not be into a shtick that is basically saying WWE's corporate speak the use of language like they have with all their buzzwords and stuff, that should be scorned and disdained. And I think it is largely. And so to have a heel group embrace it as the best ever. We love it. And we've got our own version of it here. Like, you're basically, I think, shaming WWE into having to change. So, I want to know, like, in the last month, if there have been fewer references to WWE Universe and especially sports entertainment and entertainer than there were on average in the previous, 100 months of WWE TV. Because to me, making fun of that does kind of make WWE self-conscious. Like, oh, God, is it that bad that you can base a whole heel group's persona around that kind of language? So, yes, part of me is just sort of like, I don't know, I wouldn't call it biased, but predisposed to delight in making fun of that. But I also think that, 2.0 are a blast as a character. I did not see this coming. When they got acquired by AEW, I was like, really? And I was told by some people, hey, these guys are respected and valuable, and we're going to get more out of them. And I think Tony really liked what they brought. I think the chemistry that they had with Daniel Garcia, it was just one skit. I think it was on a Dark episode. But they did a skit backstage, and 2.0 was just making Garcia crack up. Like, you could tell he was just hanging on their every word and just enjoying their performance. And I think that's how most people are with them. And they're in the right spot. We're not meant to take them super seriously or seriously at all, but they're credible enough in the ring, to take good bumps, but also do jobs. So the question is, yeah, what is next? Where do you turn this into, a money feud? And I haven't really booked that out a lot because I think we're in for, Santana, Ortiz, and Kingston for a while, which I'm fine with. Like, I don't need to know what Matt and Angel, Matt Menard and Angelo Parker are going to be feuding with next. And Danny Garcia in a prominent spot, I'm a huge fan of his, and I like that he's in a situation kind of like Sammy Guevara was early on, where I think he will genuinely get a rub from being in there with Jericho and grow into something that I think can be an even more valuable player once he, perhaps turns babyface, sort of like Sammy attempted to do. And a year or two from now, grows into something different. Mike, yeah. What do you want to add about that?
No, I was just going to say, I agree with you that I think they're going to be doing this for a while because generally that's what's happened with Jericho's feuds. Jericho's feuds have not been quick in AEW. Even going back to the MJF feud, that MJF feud felt like it was a year. And I think it was pretty close. I think it was about 8 months. 8 or 9 months by the time we were all said and done. So I would expect this to go on for a while because most of what Jericho has done has been long-term. Really, since the second he joined the company, I can't really think of one short-term feud that he's had.
Yeah, Scott, back to you.
Yeah, I can give this group, I'll just take a wait-and-see approach. Maybe the next few weeks, they kind of heated up the feud tonight, or not kind of, they really did with the Fireball segment. By the time Double or Nothing comes, they have a great match, and then if the feud's over or continues, at least I would like to see something different, just a little more something else to this act other than just inside WWE corporate type speak that they're making fun of, which is good, but I want to see something more. Other than that, I don't have much else to discuss tonight. Thanks for taking my call, and you guys have a great night.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it. Mike, do you see them growing into something else? Do they need to as an act?
Not right away, no. I mean, not for what they're doing now. I think at some point they're going to have to. And I would expect, whether it's 2.0 breaking, I think it's probably 2.0 breaking off, but I would imagine this ends with them breaking up, probably shortly after this Kingston feud is over, because I don't know really where anything they do again would just kind of be recycling what they've just done here, through the Kingston and Santana and Ortiz feud. So I think the group itself probably starts to splinter when this feud is over, but I think this feud is probably a six month thing. That's mostly been what Jericho's programs have been.
Well, what do you think of Garcia?
I like Garcia. I think he's, it's one of those. It's interesting because they had so many young talent back when they first started the company 3 years ago. And some of those guys aren't being renewed now because the makeup of their roster has changed, right? But Garcia is one that has kind of been a breakout guy for me. And I think it'll take time. I mean, it'll take time before he's really kind of pushed towards the top of the card. But they've got a few guys that are on the younger end that have come in and that I think maybe unexpectedly have gotten themselves over. Like, I don't even know that Tony thought Garcia would be at the point he is now when they signed him. I don't know what role he had envisioned for him, but he's been a guy that I think has kind of broken out and probably exceeded expectations from what they thought when they signed him.
Yeah, I want to see Danny Garcia grow. Like, I want to see his act expand. I want to see him get chances to play off of Jericho. I think he has good facial expressions. He's really good in the ring. And I don't think it's an accident that Jericho chose to work with him. You know, I mean, Jericho doesn't pick just anybody, and he's got say-so. And let's see what Garcia can grow into as an act. I think you're right. He kind of snuck up on people and surprised Tony Khan and others. I just think when they come out, I'm like, I'm going to be interested. It's a real contrast to personalities and styles. And so now, you know, we get to see them, play off each other in different ways than Jericho was able to with the Inner Circle, which I think kind of played itself out. All right,
and I think those guys being around. I think those guys being around Jericho too, in the locker room as those segments are being laid out, because like I said, Jericho has a lot to say. So Tony books the show, but I mean, I'm sure Jericho has input. His ideas are being heard, and at the very least, even if Tony tells them, "Look, this is what you're doing tonight," they're getting together, whether it's a promo segment like it was tonight or a match, and it's, I mean, Jericho's a part of those conversations. So just having someone who has 30 years of experience and being younger guys and being able to kind of pull off of that, and just it's. I'm sure it's a learning experience for those guys behind the scenes, let alone, you know, what they're going to learn in front of the camera.
All right. Our number, if you want to join the program, if you're listening to us live here, is 347-215-8558. It is not too late. Breaking news, I'm told. It is not too late to call into the show if you want to join the conversation. When you call, push 1 on your keypad. Wade Keller Podcast at pwtorch.com. Also a way to participate. All right, let's see. Up next, we got Hitton in London, Ontario. Hitton, good to hear from you. What'd you think of Dynamite?
Hey, Wade. Hey, Mike. Good to talk to you as always, Mike. I feel like it's a rare but a distinguished opportunity whenever you're on. I would like to open by echoing some of what the previous caller said. I listened to some of the flagship yesterday, and I really enjoyed the conversation about the Forbidden Door in particular. And, you know, there's, of course, a difference between a very cynical WWE loyalist that trashes AEW for abandoning the casual fans and people who discourage that concept entirely, and what we're doing here at The Torch, which is kind of, well, I don't want to say we, you guys, I suppose, constructively figuring out how best to promote, right? And I want to get Mike's take as well on one thing that you guys talked about, which is the Michael Cole versus Excalibur comparison in terms of who, without the filter of Kevin Dunn and Vince McMahon, would be the best sort of spokesman or salesman, I think is the word you guys used, to lure in or to sort of help guide the AEW viewer who perhaps doesn't know the new debutante or the new, wrestlers that are going to be making Dynamite appearances until June, right? Now, obviously, Ross from years ago would probably be best for this, but he's lost a step. Now he's probably not going to be able to do it. So if we were to kind of live in that scenario where Michael Cole's a free agent and the AEW could get him, do you think, you know, between him and someone like Excalibur, who's a little too robotic, a little too just, you know, enthusiastic and like, hey, don't you guys share my kind of innate enthusiasm that I was almost born with for this product? Would you think do you think it's a fair enough comparison between the two for who might be better salesmen for new things like this?
Yeah, it's a scary comparison to make because it's fraught with potential for backlash and scorn and laughter from people who feel very strongly on the other side. But I think Michael Cole has developed into a good announcer. And at times I think he's very good. I don't think he's going to earn, even with this generation that grew up watching him, top-tier status the way that Gordon Solie, Jim Ross, Lance Russell in his own inimitable way did. The announcers that have been really heavily praised over the years. But I think he's good to very good. And he has a very specific job to do, and he does it. And I think he does it well for not having a naturally charismatic personality. You know, Cole, there's been an awkwardness that in a lack of just kind of natural charisma that Cole has had to overcome, and I think he still is to a degree. But Excalibur is not a perfect announcer either, and I think Excalibur is not – he's more Mike Tenay in, you know, the professor relaying facts, but he's not that kind of – it's why I lamented – Cole being a heel announcer while also trying to pitch pay-per-views. It just, I thought that was ridiculous. But you need that kind of organized, trusted pitch man who can understand what the selling points are and convey it. And so that's where I think the subject is more interesting than some will give credit to in terms of would Michael Cole serve AEW better than Excalibur at this stage of AEW's game. That's not to say Cole's perfect, and it's not to say you wouldn't miss things about Excalibur. But, man, there's some things that Cole has – he's not an idiot. He's respected behind the scenes in WWE. Announcers who work under him really praise him as someone genuinely trying to make people better, working within the system and trying to make the best of it. So, Mike, yeah, I mean, you've watched so many – listened to so many announcers over the years and lived through a lot of them through Impact Wrestling and your coverage of that, and obviously AEW from the beginning, and years of watching WWE. What's your take on the kind of Cole Excalibur comparison and your thoughts on them as announcers compared to others?
It's a very interesting topic, and I would agree with you. I actually think that Cole, at this stage of his career and what he has done for the last, well, probably 5 to 6 years at this point, he is very underrated, I think, by most fans because of the fact that, like you said, for a while there, he was the heel announcer, which never made sense, and it never fit, and it made people really push back, I think, on Michael Cole. And then before that, you had people that resented Michael Cole because he was the guy that WWE handpicked to replace the guy, JR, that everybody loved. So, like, he was in a really bad spot from the beginning in that he was kind of rejected at the very, very beginning of his career because he was the handpicked guy to replace JR, and people just still wanted JR. And then they leaned into it and made him a heel, which didn't help anything at all. I think it made it worse. So, like, the first 10 years of Michael Cole, he was in a really difficult position. But since he's kind of emerged as just being the straight-faced announcer and the guy who's the host of the show, I think he's done a really good job. And I actually think he'd be a really good fit for AEW if in this universe they decided to clean up their announce team a little bit. Because the one criticism I would have right now is everybody's just the same. Like, Excalibur is kind of a play-by-play guy, and JR is kind of a play-by-play guy, and Tony's also a play-by-play guy who's doing interviews every once in a while. You know, I think I would like to see them get to a point where, and I've mentioned this in the past on our show with Andrew, and I don't know that if these individuals are even going to accept these types of roles, but if you had a play-by-play person with Excalibur, a two-man announce team, and Excalibur becomes a color guy more than he becomes a play-by-play guy, which he can do, because he does it every once in a while. He'll explain kind of the intricacies of the moves you're seeing and what wrestlers are trying to do, and he's got this guy in this hole, now he needs to try to do this to get out of it, very similar to what, you know, Daniel Cormier does on UFC broadcast. And then that allows JR to be the long-form interview guy who's sitting people down backstage and they're sitting in chairs across from each other. I think he's very good in that role. It allows Tony to be the guy who might interview someone on the stage or interview someone in the ring, kind of become their version of Gene Okerlund. I think everybody would have a more defined role. The thing that I don't like about it right now is they kind of have three kind of play-by-play guys all together And it creates a mess sometimes. And I think sometimes they assume the viewer knows more than they actually know. And there's almost not enough explanation sometimes. Sometimes there's too much, and then other times there's not enough. It's strange. Whereas Cole is just kind of I'm the play-by-play guy. I'm going to call the play-by-play. I'm going to explain things when it needs to be explained. Excalibur is going to be the analyst who's going to explain to you kind of the intricacies of what you're seeing. I think the two of them together would be very good.
Yeah. I think with the chemistry between them, it works well enough. I mean, it's not like a top-shelf problem, but it's worth pointing out where the deficiency is and see if there's a way that they can adjust how they're being produced or how they play off each other to improve it. I don't think Shivani feels like he wants to ask Excalibur questions. He doesn't do that. And Ross, because he's sort of the senior member, and I don't, it's like both of, you'd want somebody, maybe a younger announcer who's really good at the drama, that range of personality that Excalibur just doesn't show, and doing the dramatic calls of matches, who's young enough, who's young and willing to just then throw to Excalibur and say, you know what question, to know what answer to what question will enhance the storytelling of the show, as opposed to just a regurgitation of a lot of facts. And I'm just not sure that Excalibur has that instinct. He's got tons of knowledge, but there's not really a sense of this fact is really important to help bring new people in and invest people's emotions in what's happening. That's just not natural for him. And having a really good play-by-play announcer who's maybe younger and looks up to him for his knowledge and doesn't feel like it's an affront to their knowledge, which Ross has had most of his career, it might work better. So, I mean, no announced team is going to be perfect. There's going to be shortcomings, but I think that is the shortcoming there. Mike, jump in. Yeah,
I was just going to jump real quick. One guy who I think has done a really good job since he's been on Impact and kind of probably more underproduced than he has been in the past, and would kind of fit that role is Tom Hannifin. I think he's done a really good job on the Impact show with probably less people screaming in his ear than he had before.
Yes, I mean it's amazing what robots can do when rebooted. No, I think Tom Hannifin would be really interested in watching him, and it's not going to happen, but watching him take over Rampage in a two-man booth with Taz or Samoa Joe, who is good on Raw, or I'm trying to think or Ricky Starks, you know, but have a more traditional dynamic of play-by-play man who's curious and knows how to ask the right questions, knows what points to emphasize, and is naturally and clearly the play-by-play guy, then asking a veteran wrestler or a current wrestler who's got experience on color, and having that dynamic, calling the AEW product with all the talent and all the international names and all the interpromotional work stuff that they do, and all the talent that comes in that isn't well-known to everybody or not well-known to most. I'm just curious how people would look at the product different. And we just don't get that contrast because Excalibur is everywhere. And I get why Tony puts him everywhere. But anyway, yeah, so enough on that for me. Hinton, back to you.
Yeah, I'd also add that one of the other reasons, of course, people like Michael Cole is that, you know, stuff Vince McMahon forces him to say. And you think of him in the context of New Japan, and my mind immediately goes to how he – every time he talks about Shinsuke Nakamura, he's like, come on, Shin. And the word Shin just, he's the only guy that says it. It annoys me.
It feels too familiar. Who are you to call him by a name only his friend should call him?
Yeah, and like no one else does. And it's like, did you know him in Japan? I doubt you did, right? So it was, it's weird to think of him in like the Japan context. But overall, I mean, in a perfect world, I'd say unfiltered Michael Cole with Taz, who, you know, that was a commentary team on SmackDown. That is, when I started watching wrestling, it was them, you know, that really brought me in. And guess who was on the roster? A bunch of good wrestlers. There was Benoit, Guerrero, Angle, Brian Kendrick, Paul London. I mean, you know, the SmackDown 6, Rey Mysterio, a good cruiserweight division. All these guys who, you know, had great matches, and Cole and Taz were there to call it. So it's not like they're, you know, it's not like they're too much of a, you know, storytelling, quote-unquote, type of announcer. That they're good with the wrestling when need be, and then Taz can go into the moves. I don't think you need Excalibur at all, I mean, in that scenario. But, you know, one can dream, I suppose.
I don't see the announcing as a glaring weakness, but I think the weaknesses are worth pointing out, and I think they're worth making an attempt to correct through some adjustments. I guess I'll just say that. I don't think they should just settle in and be like, we got it perfect. I think it's worth figuring out if they can change the dynamic, and part of that is just how Tony produces them. But you know, there's different personalities, different egos, and different experience levels, and a history now with those, where sometimes it is a little tough to change on the fly. But anyway, I'll hand back to you for a subject change.
Yeah, absolutely. And just a final note on that, I think Jim Ross has had a better string of weeks ever since he's been back. Obviously, he's not the Jim Ross of old, but he's just been better. I've just not had moments where I'm like, oh, come on, Jim. Apart from like some women's matches. But I want to talk about Wardlow next, which I think is a very good example of a story that's fit within the Dynamite, you know, canon, and we haven't really had much homework to do about it, so I want to really give it some credit. I think the performances of everyone involved have been great so far. You know, Wardlow's getting at least some reaction. I thought he had a decent match with Lance Archer today, and Big Cass, I think, his opponent for next week. any idea what this guy has been doing on the indies? Because he doesn't strike me as anyone more threatening than Lance Archer, you know, based on how he was treated in WWE.
Yeah, he's been doing good work on Impact Wrestling, and I think there's a novelty to bringing him in. I'm curious if they choose to protect his Impact, the place that he has in Impact Wrestling. You don't want him to just come in and just get squashed, but at the same time, I don't think his character is one where it's just devastated by losing to a guy like Wardlow, who's powering through everybody right now, even in a competitive situation with Archer. So, Mike, I'll throw to you both on what you thought of how they handled Wardlow. How you think the Wardlow storyline in general is going, how the match with Lance Archer was booked, and how Archer came out of it, and then the W. Morrissey Big Cass tease by MJF.
I think the Wardlow stuff has really worked better than I expected, too. I didn't expect it to work this much, this well. But I think he's, you know, especially tonight, I noticed it when he came out with the security around him. He's beginning to feel more and more like a star than I thought he was going to at this stage, which is interesting because he's doing it without music and without graphics and just wearing, you know, black ring gear because that's part of this whole deal. But it's working for me. I think it's working really well. And he's starting to feel like a guy. Before this whole split with MJF happened, I did not think he was a guy that you could see main eventing shows at some point. It felt like he was going to be a guy who was going to be really good, but probably, you know, just short of ever, you know, being a regular main event guy, at least from a pay-per-view standpoint. But he's shown a lot here in this thing with MJF over the last couple of months that has me thinking otherwise. Just, I think when he was MJF's lackey, he just didn't have the opportunity to kind of emote anything other than I am a monster who's here to do MJF's dirty work. And it's given him an opportunity to kind of explore a different side of his character and a different side of his personality, which has been good. And he's really improved in the ring. Like he's really improved in the ring. And I think next week will be good with W. Morrissey. Like you said, he's done some really good stuff at Impact. He's kind of emerged there and been a guy that they've utilized near the top of their card. So that should be a really good match. And I've been very impressed with Wardlow, which has surprised me because I honestly did not think I would have been. But he's done a really, really good job since they've really leaned into this split with MJF.
What is Wardlow's real upside? Should people realize as they get into the momentum of his character playing off of MJF that he might struggle a little bit when he's not playing off of MJF and when, you know, given what the expectations are for world-class main event matches that AEW promotes, can Wardlow really be, I mean, can you really put him in a main event of a pay-per-view? How far away is he from that? Or does he not need that to just be very valuable as a different kind of wrestler, but he's, you know, third, fourth from the top at best almost all the time?
I think that's probably where he'll settle into. I do think you can kind of flirt with him and being near the top of your card every once in a while. He's done enough, I think, and he's getting better. And the other thing is, I think, you know, from Tony's standpoint, at some point, even if it's somebody that isn't going to have a match on the level of what, you know, Kenny Omega has been able to do, you're going to want to stamp a main event with someone that you can say is, well, this is my guy. I discovered this guy. I booked this guy from the very beginning. He's my guy. Whereas, you know, Kenny Omega was never a main event guy in WWE, but he was still a main event guy in Ring of Honor and New Japan. Same with Hangman Page. He was a prominent star in Ring of Honor. So those guys, they're non-WWE guys, but I don't know if you can – if Tony really feels like, you know, this is a guy that I took and I groomed and I turned him into – you know, I helped turn him into this main event guy. And I think Wardlow, you could definitely look at Wardlow through that lens. So I have to think at some point, if he continues to improve at the level he has so far, you could get away with putting him in a main event against the right person, you know, and again, and under the right circumstances. Like, I'm not saying he's going to be there consistently all the time, but
yeah.
As they've experienced in the past, if you have a sudden run of injuries and you're stuck or whatever. I mean, I think he's a guy you could put there and he can give you a good match, especially with the right opponent. In a similar way, I would compare it to what they had to do a little over a year ago when John Moxley and Eddie Kingston main evented a pay-per-view. I'm not sure people would have said, you know, Eddie Kingston's going to be able to main event an AEW pay-per-view,
yeah.
Considering who else was in the company at the time. But the circumstances, they needed somebody in that spot, and he was obviously a great promo, and it fit. So I think Wardlow with the right person could be in a spot like that, where he's just on a regular basis just below the main event, but he's a guy that you can slide in there for a match every once in a while if you absolutely needed to, if the circumstances were right.
All right, Hinton, back to you.
Yeah, good points about that. Wanted to also talk about the women's match that we saw today, and this is another feud that I think has been building quite well over television, except for the fact that we sometimes have weeks with a whole lot of nothing. Serena Deeb and Hikaru Shida. I was into this feud more than any of Britt Baker's last three feuds, for example. But there's just been a lot of, you know, I was worried tonight that the match wouldn't have as much heat because, again, they just spent too long doing nothing. But if you just put together everything that they did do to build up the match, it was great. And the match itself, I thought tonight delivered. I thought it was, you know, I thought Deeb getting the win was really good because Deeb has just, she's got more upside in a feud against Thunder Rosa, I think, than Hikaru Shida does. Just her character, the professor gimmick, et cetera. It'd be good for a character like that to carry Thunder Rosa to a good kind of long-term feud. So what did you make of the match, the build-up, as well as the outcome?
Mike, were you surprised at the outcome and the way they just put over Deeb? And I like the matchup. I think it's good for Thunder Rosa to have somebody like Deeb as the next opponent, and I'm happy for Deeb. Your thoughts?
I am in agreement there. I think Serena Deeb has been very good since they brought her in. She flew under the radar for a little bit. She's really taken off here over the last few months. I think she's going to, especially Andrew and I talked this week a little bit about how the women's division in AEW is getting a little deeper in terms of just the number of talent on the roster, but they're still, they have a lot of people on the roster that are inexperienced. And she's someone that can be a veteran and can work with that talent and can help push forward some of that new talent. So I'm happy with the way this has gone, because I think she's in the perfect spot to not only be featured on the show, but help groom the generation of wrestlers in that division that are going to be coming after her, you know, in the next 5 to 6 years.
Would you want Deeb to have a run with the belt?
I wouldn't mind it.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't mind it at all. I think the way they've presented her, like over the last 6 to 8 months, I think it would fit. Sure.
Yeah. Hint, how about you?
I am desperate for it, actually. I think she is way better than anyone gives credit for. It's just she's been a coach for so long, so I think she has that stench of, oh, I'm just a veteran here to put other people over. Whereas, no, you're performing much better than even the quote-unquote most popular woman on the roster, Britt Baker. Like, you're a better heel. Frankly, you'd be a better babyface than she was. So, yeah, I mean, I'd love to see it.
Yeah. Hint, anything else?
Final point was on the the opening match between Wheeler and Harwood. I thought it was a great match. I thought, you know, you can hear Jim Ross get giddy every time, you know, a match like this gets put on. And yeah, I couldn't take my eyes away from the screen either. Of course, the build to this was horrendous, just horrendous. They put it on. They put everything good about it on YouTube. There was like a 10-second teaser on Rampage, which half the people saw. If you blinked it, you missed it. If I wasn't doing the hits and misses, I would have missed it myself, so I didn't have to write about it. And I had to actually rewind, actually, to catch up with it. So it was the build was awful, but I think the execution was good. I noticed that you said that they wonder if they flipped a coin to decide who would win. I'm not surprised that Dax won. I think Dax has just had a more consistent kind of upside. He's always been the more dominant ones on promos and such. I think they trust him to have a good run in this tournament as a singles act more than Cash Wheeler. But your thoughts on this?
Yeah, they opened that match, Mike. It's kind of what I anticipated the match would be like. I thought they were sort of masterful in telling a story that felt believable and intense. I like the commentary where they pointed out, hey, this is a partner pile driving his own partner. This could affect them going forward. In the end, I don't know if they flipped a coin to see who would win, but I think most people see Dax as the leader and the one who probably should win. I'm not quite sure why. But it was a fun opening match. It was novel, and I thought it had just enough time, and it earned the minutes it got.
Yeah, I love this match, and I agree with you. I kind of do see Dax as the leader, and I think a lot of people do. For whatever reason, I don't know if it's just the way he presents himself and this presence that he has, but I really, really enjoy this. This felt like this brought me back to watch. It felt like I was watching a match from when I was a kid, you know, where yeah, there were some high spots, but it was just a good wrestling match. It wasn't filled with, you know, bing, 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 bing guys bouncing off ropes and doing springboards and doing dives to the outside. It was slowed down compared to today's modern style. But it was really good. And it did. It felt like a match that I would watch as a kid. And I really, really enjoyed it.
All right, cool. Hinton, anything else for us?
No, that's all, guys. Thanks for taking my call, Mike. Really great to talk to you as always. And Wade, of course.
Oh, thanks, Hinton. I was feeling bad there for a half a second. Cool. Always good to hear from you, Hinton. Thanks. All right. Up next, we'll go to Ryan in Cumberland, Maryland. And unless anyone else chimes in, we'll hit some emails and I'll scroll through the show to see if there's anything else I want to talk to Mike about. Also, let's go to Ryan in Cumberland, Maryland. Ryan, welcome. Have you got three things for us?
Yes, I do. First question is on the FTR match. You think after the impressive showing those two had that Tony Khan will possibly book another tag team against tag team partner match in the next year, and who do you think that might be?
Mike, what do you think?
You know, it's interesting. I think they could. This one fit because of the tournament. And, you know, one guy was going to be able to advance and qualify for the tournament, and one guy wasn't. So I don't know. They would have to find a story that fit for teammates to face each other as opposed to just throwing it out there and having teammates face each other. But, yeah, I don't think it'll be the last time they do it. I could see, I mean, down the road, and this could be years down the road, but I could see, you know, the Young Bucks having a match against each other at some point for whatever reason. And there's a number of teams that I think will almost surely break up and have matches against each other at some point.
Jungle Boy Luchasaurus?
Yeah.
That maybe at some point would be, you know, it's not a match where you'd expect them to be feuding or anything like that. But I think that could work. I don't want to see Matt against Jeff. You know, I'm thinking of the spirit of, like, you know, just sort of a one-off match. Sky and Paige, that feels like they would be breaking up if they did that. The Acclaimed would be fun. in a situation like this. Maybe that would almost have to lead to some sort of storyline change if they went that route. Yeah, I don't know. Ryan, does anyone jump out for you?
I thought the Young Bucks was the first thing that came to mind just because of their popularity.
Oh, sure, yeah.
They haven't really been featured against each other like the Hardys have.
Yep.
Okay, my,
yep.
My second question is on this big announcement that they're going to make their debut in Detroit and Los Angeles. And I know COVID, you know, they weren't touring, but was there a reason, like, when AEW first started, like, in that 4 or 5 months that they were going around touring, that they didn't go to these major cities? Because you think that would be, like, the first two places they would go since they're so largely populated.
Mike?
Yeah, I'm sure they had to have had some sort of metrics to as far as choosing whether they went early on, because they did kind of – they kind of stuck to the Northeast a little bit, you know, right at the very beginning. I mean, the first show was D.C., then I think Boston was right after that. I was at that show. I think it was the second one. And then they were like Philadelphia right after Boston. So they were all kind of very much centered in the Northeast. And I wonder if I'm talking about the first Dynamites, right? I mean, they had those specials early on, the Bleacher Report specials, and they had the Double or Nothing pay-per-view, and even the first All Out pay-per-view, I think, before they ended up on the air on TNT for the first Dynamite. So I wonder if the only thing I could think of, and Tony's very data-driven, I wonder if they had some data as far as who was purchasing those streams and who was purchasing the pay-per-views that kind of dictated where they went early on with those shows. And I think the pandemic happened, like you said, so that kind of delayed things. But now they're in a position where, you know, the first show in L.A. is going to be huge, and the first show in Detroit is going to be huge. And the first show, I mean, when they can ever get over the border and do their first show in Toronto, I think it's going to be massive because Toronto is such a good wrestling market. So one of the good things about being stuck and not being able to travel for such a long period of time is I think there is a lot of anticipation built for these debuts in major cities that just because of the circumstances haven't happened yet.
Ryan, anything else? But by the way, I agree with you, Mike. I think it's like the build up, and I know the pandemic changed things, and you know that's why it happened. But the build up to hitting some of these markets for the first time, I think it's just it gives a burst of new energy to live crowds in AEW. It's not like a master plan, but it's how it's worked out, and I think it'll be pretty exciting. Some cities are going to have a lot to live up to, given how enthusiastic some of the regular stops have been. Go ahead, Ryan.
My final points on this Forbidden Door pay-per-view, with the one being such a big part of AEW, like we saw tonight in the Serena Deeb match, and with New Japan not having any female wrestlers, to my knowledge, do you think the woman will be left off this pay-per-view, or do you think they'll find a way to get them to have a match on this pay-per-view?
I think they'll be on the pay-per-view. Mike?
Yeah, I think so too. Even if it's against each other, I think they'll within their own division. I mean, I think they'll find a way to get them on the show somehow.
Mike, how do you feel about the women's division right now in AEW with the two titles, kind of two co-leaders, which Jade Cargill and Britt Baker over the last year, but now you've got Thunder Rosa, great worker at the top, and they're moving Serena Deeb as a good worker into the mix. You've got Toni Storm added. I thought Ruby Soho and Toni Storm had a nice segment tonight, opposite of Britt and Jamie. So are things in the best spot they've been in that you can recall in AEW history? By a lot, not by much, or do you disagree with the premise that things are in a good spot compared to in the past?
No, I think they're in the best spot they've been in since the company's been around. And it was just because the struggles they had at the very beginning, which is depth. Like it was – I felt like it was, you know, Riho and Britt Baker and Sheeta for – it was just the three of them for, like – and Nyla Rose, the four of them, for the first year, because it's really all that they had. It was kind of the same matches just being recycled over and over and over again. So they're a lot deeper now, and I think they've been smart in the way that, you know – they haven't done this with the men's titles, but they're doing it with the women's titles, and that Jade is – she's on Dynamite here and there, but she's also kind of – a Rampage talent. I mean, not specifically, but it feels like most of her big matches are on Rampage. So it kind of gives Rampage something that's unique to just Rampage, and also spaces out the fact that they have two women's titles. And you know, really, I mean, until WWE split it with Raw and SmackDown, no one has really ever had two women's singles titles in the last 30 years. So, and is their roster, I mean, we can get into a conversation about whether their roster is actually deep enough to support two titles. I don't know if it is yet. I think it's close. It's getting there because it is in the best position it's ever been in. But it's not in the way. Like, the fact that they've kept the TBS title only on Rampage, for the most part, I think, has helped kind of space it out and not feel like, oh, man, it's watered down with these two titles.
What network is Rampage on? Never mind. It
That's
matter.
A good point.
Yeah, no,
that
no.
That's a good point. The it's an accurate TNT title main event on TBS.
Yeah. It is an accurate point. I don't think it's super super relevant. I don't think they should change course on where they feature the title, but it just struck me as like, oh, that's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
Ryan, thank you. Are you going to surprise us with anything else, or is that about it? Did you like tonight's show?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. And I think that's all I have for you. But you never did find out about William if he was an old childhood friend, so you're still keeping me on the suspense on that one.
Oh, yeah. Email me so I can mark it down as something that I'll like actually remember and try to follow up on.
All right.
Cool. Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it. Speaking of email, Mike, we got some emails to get to.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Let's begin our emails with Shay from Brooklyn. Another really fun Dynamite. What they're doing with Wardlow has been pretty great week to week. Tonight, he got to show a little more of what he can do, and I think he's really delivering each time. Wardlow has always been on my radar, even when he was just in the background making ridiculous mean faces. He's putting everything together. He feels like a real person now, and I've enjoyed the patience they've had with his development. It's a fun journey to witness, and MJF is a perfect heel for this role, and you can tell all of his feuds have been done with great care. AEW has always had a great tag division, but I'm really surprised to find myself craving the Trios title I once felt would be overkill. They have a lot of interesting three-man tag teams to choose from, and I hope they get around to those titles sooner than later. House of Black, Death Triangle, BCC, Eddie Santana Ortiz, and Adam Cole with Red Dragon or Bucks all feel like main event-worthy Trios teams already. I'd throw Jungle Boy, Luchasaurus, and Christian in there, and you could do an angle. Very happy to have Phoenix back. He has an energy to him not many have. Agree on that. I really enjoy all the story beats AEW sprinkle throughout the show. Dynamite really demands my attention, and I appreciate the effort to make every segment matter. Mike, your thoughts on any of that, and I would say in particular, the Trios title, and are you on Team Ross and Team Wade when it comes to calling it a six-man title, or are you on Team Excalibur and Team Tony as a Trios title?
I would call it a six-man title for me.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest with you, too. Like, I don't really want to see that yet. I think we're okay. I'd push that off as long as you can. Just because you have enough going on right now that trying to feature another division with another set of titles. I mean, we've talked about a couple of times about how quickly the show's paced because it's like, we got to get all this stuff in. If now all of a sudden you're trying to get in another division with another championship, I think it could even create some more rush and kind of hecticness to the show at times. So I'm okay waiting as long as possible.
What about there being belts for everybody? You know, the diminishing return factor. Even if something would be nice and you can do something positive with it, in the aggregate, is it just too many people walking around with belts and it takes away, you know, I mean, like, again, the NHL playoffs are going on right now. And I remember when there were 21 teams in the NHL and 16 made the playoffs. And, you know, grumpy, grizzled veteran columnists would be like, you know, in the NHL, the whole regular season doesn't count. Home ice isn't that important. Only five teams don't make it. It's crazy. Now they have, you know, 30-plus teams, and it makes more sense, and it's fine. But, you know, so there were, like, playoff spots for everyone, but there was still just one Stanley Cup. With AEW, I'm not saying there's not just one Stanley Cup. There's the major women's and the major men's title. You don't have Cody around anymore saying the TNT title isn't secondary. It's an equal because it shouldn't be. The TNT title should be defended more often, kind of like a traditional TV championship is. And it should be, whether it's formal and structured or informal and happenstance, wrestled amongst people who are choosing not to be in the world title picture because they frankly aren't at that level. And I think that's the right way to do it. But when you start having titles from other companies like ROH, and then you have people carrying Japan titles and people carrying titles from Mexico, and now you add more belts to AEW, and you also had the belt collector and the Impact title, I do think there is a cost that comes with it. And I don't think AEW should ignore it and get, you know, belt happy because it seems like a good idea in isolation. There's a lot of match finishes that seem like a good idea in isolation, but they're ridiculous if that match finish also happened three other times earlier in the show, or even sometimes one other time. So anyway, those are my that's sort of my take on being against adding even six-man titles, because it might be fun in isolation for the reasons that Shay brought up, but it's just too many belts. If AEW had been disciplined and not had belts from other companies pretty consistently and constantly on their TV show, and if they hadn't just had, you know, Sami carrying around two TNT title belts for no reason, maybe I'd be less strident on this point of view.
I think it's a great point. They also, I mean, they did it tonight. You know, the FTR had their match at the beginning of the show, and they referenced the ROH tag team titles, and there's all these AAA tag team titles, and there's also, well, yeah, we have our own these AEW tag team titles. There's belts everywhere, and I do think there's diminishing returns eventually when it comes to everyone having a belt. I feel the same way in WWE when you have two world titles and a U.S. title and an intercontinental title and a 24/7 title and a cruiserweight title and this, and there's so many belts, it's hard to keep track of. You know, there's times, and it got this way, especially in WWE, where so you could ask me at any given point in time, who's the Intercontinental Champion? And I would have no idea because there's, and I would watch the show regularly. There's just too much going on. There's too many belts. Whereas, you know, and I'm not saying you got to go back to this, but when I was a kid, I mean, you asked me who the Intercontinental title was, I could tell you not only who was the current champion, I could probably tell you who he beat and what show he beat him on. I would like to see them not overindulge and not fill up the show with too many belts, because I think it makes it too hard to follow.
All right, we'll go to Henderson in Charlotte, North Carolina. He goes, hey guys, the Combat Club is awesome. It's a treat to see these guys every week. My only critique is Bryan Danielson should stop doing his backflip off the top rope. It was great for his WWE character style. That's not a dig at WWE. I enjoy their product too. But it doesn't fit in with a group of guys that want to, quote, kick heads in and beat people up. The opponent always has to stall for time while he finishes the flip, and that takes me out of the moment. I'm not sure if Brian doesn't do it as fast as he used to, but it reminds me of the old quote, just because you can doesn't mean you should. I should add, Brian Danielson is my favorite wrestler. That's just a little thing that bugs me. Oh, these haters, Mike, these haters. The last thing, when MJF made the birth control joke, they cut to a guy and his girlfriend in the crowd. The guy, trying to get his girlfriend's reaction to see if it was okay to laugh, she was laughing. That's the kind of important camera cuts I like to see. Reminds me of Will Smith and his wife. Pat on the back to the guy.
I was going to say that, yeah.
A pat on the back to the guy calling that shot in Gorilla. Thanks for all the great work at the Torch. Thank you, Anderson. I appreciate it. That is a great, like, crowd shot. You know, just it's you know, a couple. We don't know if they're – I assume they're not brother sister. It seemed like there was a different dynamic, but I don't recall exactly. It probably was a romantic couple, and the reaction to them and just what they represented about what AEW is about, which is, you know, it's a product for adults that I think is successfully and strategically appealing to men and women as a thing that, you know, a couple in their 20s or 30s or whatever can go to and have a good time. And finding the right people to react to MJF's joke is good. It's good camera work.
Yeah, it's interesting because I have a younger brother who's 11 years younger than I am, who never watched wrestling growing up and did not enjoy WWE. He would go to shows with me every once in a while and would never get into it. He watches AEW now.
Yep,
it's something that he's been able to get into, and he's in his. How old is he? He's in his late 20s. So it's interesting that he's gravitated to this when he's never gravitated to wrestling before. But, you know, he's brought it up, and I didn't even tell him to watch it. He came to me with, you know what, I was checking out this show. Like, I kind of got into it. I've been watching it every week, and it's very interesting, that whole dynamic.
As far as what Henderson said about Combat Club, that's a level of detail I really appreciate. I mean, I think we got great calls and great emails, and I appreciate them. And the idea of going, all right, Brian, you can do that. You're my favorite wrestler. You can do that. It's exciting. But is it best for what you're currently doing? Is it necessary? I think that's a worthwhile point. And there comes a time where it just makes sense to edit some things that you can do to better fit the current framing of your character. Is that a good example, Mike, or does that not, did that not jump out to you, or do you think that it's not a particularly prudent point to make because it would actually take something away from the act of Brian didn't do it?
So it didn't actually stand out to me until he brought up the point in the email, but I think it is a valid point and a very good point, and it's something that, to bring up somebody else on the roster, that Chris Jericho has tended to do pretty well throughout the course of his career. Like if he's a heel, there are certain elements of his character that he will take away and he'll augment other things. And I'm actually a little surprised that given what they're doing, what he's doing with himself now, that he's not moving away from like the theme song, for example, because everybody still sings it. People sang it tonight as he came to the ring. But yeah, and the same thing there with Danielson, that maybe if, and it's not a babyface heel dynamic so much with Danielson as much as it's a, is this really playing into what your character is at the moment? I think it's a good point. I didn't notice it, but now that he's mentioned it, I do think it is a very good point.
Now we can't unsee it, Henderson. Thanks a lot. Those haters.
Yeah, exactly.
No, this is what I mean, though. It's like people who are going, I love AEW, I love this wrestler. What will bring me more into the product and invest more and not have an awkward moment in a match? By the way, AEW, one area they can improve is on the implausible coincidences. And we had another one early in the show where you know, we want to take on one of the top five contenders. and so I think it was Christian who said that. We want to take on any top five team. And boom, immediately Ricky Starks and Powerhouse Hobbs walk into the picture, go, we're top five, we want it. It's like, what?
Incredible,
like,
timing.
I like how do you just – is everyone just huddled around there watching all the promos while they're being filmed? Or, like, why were they there? And I just would like to see them put it through a realism filter, a plausibility filter a little more. And I know it's inconvenient. You know, like, oh, now we got to bring them back later. We got to, like, how do we get that accomplished? I'd say whatever inconvenience there is, you don't have that sort of eye-rolling moment that I think a lot of viewers have, which is, oh, God. Here's an impromptu open challenge from Christian. And like, if Christian had said, like, this isn't like the perfect, necessarily I'm presenting this as a perfect alternative, but Christian could have put that out on social media earlier in the day and said, earlier, I said, we're ready to take on anybody in the top five. And so far today, and then he looks off camera and he goes, oh, he gets startled, not in a Tony Khan way, but in a like normal human being way. looks off camera. And then he goes, oh, I see some people walking up right now. And then you pause for a beat of 2 seconds. And then that's when Starks and Hobbs walk in. Oh, yeah, we saw your social media thing earlier. We've been looking for you. And we just saw you were cutting a promo. We accept your challenge. You know, just something along those lines. Again, I'm sitting here thinking about it for 10 seconds. I think that's better. I think it's more realistic. And it makes the show better when there aren't sort of those eye-rolling moments where if you're watching with someone who doesn't watch wrestling and isn't super forgiving – they're going to be like, well, that was kind of stupid. That was fake. And you want to minimize that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that necessarily you're going to do that and have people praising you for it necessarily. But what it will do is it will prevent people. Because I had the same
absence
reaction.
Of a negative.
Exactly. I think I even put something on Twitter about it. I was like, wow, what a great coincidence. They were just walking by like at that exact moment. That as soon as Christian said that, they were able to walk on screen. It prevents people like me being able to do that. Removing a negative is always a positive.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, how can people follow you on Twitter, speaking of which?
It's very easy. Torch McMahon. We kept it as simple as possible.
At Torch McMahon. Very good. You can follow me on Twitter at The Wade Keller and follow our brand at PW Torch. All right. Up next in the mailbag is JB from Detroit. What do you guys see Black Bull Combat Club doing at Double or Nothing? They've been entertaining to me, but they don't seem to have a clear feud set up, and we're only about a month out. What do you think, Mike?
Oof. I don't even know. Yeah, they don't seem like they have much. I'm sure they could slide them into anything really at this point, but I don't – there's nothing that immediately comes to mind.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they could do Starks and – it doesn't have to be all three of them, but you would think Danielson and Moxley should be in a tag match and Yuta in a singles match, if not in a three-on-three. But then, you know, who are – what heel tag team can step up and seem like, you know, credible pay-per-view worthy opponents? And I mean, you know, we talk about how deep the AEW roster is, but I mean, I'm kind of stumped too. Give your suggestions, email them in. We'll take a look at it, or you can mention it on Twitter and include our handles and get a discussion going on that. I suspect it's a big enough act, a significant enough act. They've got to have somebody in mind.
Yeah, I would think so. I would think you have to.
All right, number two from JB in Detroit. Did AEW just rip off NXT's fireball angle from a year or two back when Karrion Kross fireballed Keith Lee with Kingston and Jericho this week? It was dumb then, too. The fireball's been around a long time. They often don't look good. Eddie was selling fireball to the eyes, but it sort of flew over his forehead. It was pre-taped, so they could have redone it, but I'm not for people actually having fireballs thrown at their face either if it's going to actually cause issues. I'm sort of agnostic on fireballs used on rare occasion, and I think this was a pretty good occasion to use it. I think Eddie Kingston getting in Jericho's face and causing Kingston to lean back, or causing Jericho to have to lean back and just take that kind of verbal beating, and he couldn't respond because they were, you know, committed to no physicality during the interview. It made sense that Jericho's pride would be hurt and he'd want to lash back, and that he would do so in a way that felt like it was going too far. And I like that the announcers sold it. You know, they didn't just move on to the next thing. Well, they did move on to the next thing, but there was 10 seconds of using a bunch of words about, you know, heinous and uncalled for and whatever. They used better adjectives than I just did there. I thought it worked for me. I thought it worked well enough. Mike, what do you think?
I thought it worked. I mean, unless I'm just forgetting something completely obvious, I don't remember them doing a fireball before. Was it the first one they've done? Did they ever do one in one of the stadium Stampede matches or anything like that?
That was
my immediate thought. I was like, yeah, you know what? They've held out, because that's a pretty traditional wrestling thing, the fireball to the face. And I'm not sure I've seen AEW do one before.
My over-under would have been one, but I can't specifically think of it. You know what I mean? Like, it feels like they did it before.
They do a lot.
Yeah. Yes. My truthiness meter says they did it once, but I really don't. No. So yeah, I mean, if they did it once before in 3 years, that's fine too. Okay. So JB says the announcement for the Hook and Danhausen match seems to get a big pop. Hard to tell if it was sweetened or not because it wasn't in front of the crowd, but I think it deserves more fanfare than an Excalibur bloated rundown. Does it, Mike? Deserve more fan? I guess it does. I mean, they've put months into building up Hook, and Danhausen is, you know, a comedy character that probably protects Hook from being exposed for being green, and it allows Hook to, you know, kind of play off with his body language and facial expressions, you know, in a different way than Orange Cassidy. But, you know, there's a story told with minimal words, obviously, and body language with Hook. I'm okay with that match, and I almost think if you draw too much attention to it, it might actually cause more of a pushback than putting it out there. But I think just generically, generally speaking, I'm not for match announcements being in the midst of a rapid-fire barrage of being pelted with a ton of things to remember. And really, I wish that they put a slideshow of graphics up every time they announce future matches and just slow down a little bit. You know, show us a graphic of each of the matches that you're talking about. I think visual representation goes a long way to add to the audio plugs. And I think it's worth an extra 20 seconds of TV time right before the main event to do that.
Totally agree. I think the visual component is huge. As for this match, so I will admit, I don't get Danhausen. I don't understand it.
have you seen him before, or are you pretty new to him in AEW? Like, have you followed
pretty
his journey?
New.
Yeah. So, and that's part of the thing too, is like they dropped him in, and it's like, I mean, I guess in someone might say it's self-explanatory, but I never thought the boop and the Chris Statlander alien thing was self-explanatory. Jim Ross grumbled about it on air, deservedly so, and thankfully she's, you know, drop that and has a new act, you know, a total new shtick. So, yeah, with Danhausen, I wish that there was – we were told the story from a new beginning for him. And, yeah, it's not for everybody.
Yeah, and it's – so I guess in that regard, I'm okay that they're not building it up all that much because I do think Hook – although he is obviously green, has a future and has shown some promise. And I don't know that you want to necessarily advertise too heavily that he's going to be in there with a comedy character. And as much as I will admit, I don't get it. You listen to the reaction that he often gets, whether it's when they're in video packages and you can hear the live crowd or when it's in front of the live crowd and people react to him. So if I'm Tony, I would continue to present him as well. Even if I don't get it, it doesn't mean that, you know, he's not writing the show just for me. So if there's enough people that are reacting to it, I mean, I said the same thing about Orange Cassidy. I never understood it. I never got it. It never sank in with me why Orange Cassidy was as popular as he was, especially when he was feuding with Jericho, but clearly it was working. So,
yeah.
You know, just judging by the reaction, you keep pushing that guy because it was working. Even if it doesn't necessarily connect with me, it's connecting with enough people that I can understand why he's being utilized.
All right. Up next from JB, what are your thoughts on the TNT as of recent? I think it means TNT title. It seems to change on a whim and be more about being the impetus for angles rather than holding a prestige. Did they rather just flip the title back-to-back weeks for a semi-heel turn? Seems unnecessary. On top of that, that last match was incredibly overbooked with Sami and Ty, American Top Team, and Kazarian all coming out at the end. So, yeah, I mean, we covered the TNT title. I'm giving them a mulligan, given special circumstances. I want them to be nimble. And like I said, that, you know, I don't mind every once in a while rapid-fire title changes because it keeps you on edge. But I'm like I said, I'm ready for a long-term champion, whether it's Sky or someone else. Let's get to it. Let's settle in and make sure it doesn't become sort of a parody or – yeah, I don't know what better word there is. You don't want it to become 24/7-esque, where, you know, it's just like, oh, you know, I'm champion for 1 to 3 weeks, and the average reign is really short. But was the main event overbooked? Did they need to have that many people involved? Did it serve a purpose, or was it just to create chaos?
I think it was just to create chaos. Like, I'm assuming that at some point, I mean, it seemed like they were going to do the Cody and Brandy against Paige Van Zant and whoever she was with. Was it with Sky originally? Maybe back when Paige Van Zant and Brandy had hooked up on TV and they were going at it at one point right before that they had left the company. Yeah, you know, it seemed like they were going to do some type of mixed tag. So it kind of feels like they booked the women to be involved to set up that down the road, maybe to kind of replace what they lost there when Cody and Brandy left. And I mean, I have a lot of questions about the main event. We talked about it earlier in the show, but like, I would also question, why did it need to be a ladder match to begin with? Not only was there a lot of chaos involved at the end of it, but why exactly was it a ladder match? It's a fun match. There was a lot of cool spots as we talked about, but you know, usually there's a reason why ladder matches happen, just like there's usually a reason why cage matches happen. It's not just like, well, this is we spun a wheel and this is what we're gonna do this week. It did feel like it was a little overbooked, even from the very beginning of just why is it a ladder match just for the spots. Okay, I guess, but there was a lot going on. It was chaotic.
I don't think there's a hard and fast rule that all, you know, that the vast majority of wrestling matches should just be straight one-on-one or two-on-two matches. That shouldn't just be like a rule that doesn't get evaluated for its for whether it makes sense. But if you think about it, it makes sense. So I'm not saying it's like, I mean, in other words, it's not just blind faith that that's the way things should be. It's the way things should be because you want gimmick matches. You want first a baseline of what pro wrestling is. And then I think you want to have exceptions for a reason. Like Sami Zayn needed a lumberjack match to keep him in the ring. Oh, the lumberjacks kept fighting. Sami skirted out of the ring. Now we're going to put him in a cage. Let's see if that can keep him from getting intentionally counted out. There's a logic to it. There should be a reason, an impetus for adding a stipulation to a match other than won't it be athletically exciting? And I think that there's sort of a lack of discipline and a lack of philosophy, booking philosophy that is on display when there's this many gratuitous, seems like too strong of an adjective, but just excessive stipulations and special stips and matches in AEW. I want it to feel special when a ladder match comes out. And, you know, if a ladder match was once a year, it would really mean something. It's kind of like title belts. There's diminishing returns over time.
Yeah, and they've done that a couple of times. I mean, they've had, like, I think there's been two or three Texas death matches. It's like every time we're in Texas, we have to have a Texas death match. Yeah. As opposed to, you know, you go back to the very first, at least the first prominent ladder match in the U.S. was the Razor Shawn match was because there was two belts. You know, yeah. Shawn was suspended, had a belt. They created another belt. So we're going to do this ladder match, and someone's got to climb the ladder and take both belts. Like, yeah. there was a reason behind it. There was a story behind it. It wasn't just, we're just going to do a ladder match at WrestleMania 10 because we want to do one. Like, there was a reason behind it.
That's right. Yep. All right, JB has a fourth and final question. When will Eddie Kingston, Santana, and Ortiz get their two-wrestler backup to even the odds with Jericho Appreciation Society, and who will those two people be, and will it happen before Double or Nothing? As always, love the show, and go VIP, people. Thank you, JB. Do they need to go? I mean, do Hager and 2.0 count enough, or Garcia count enough, where every faction that feuds needs to have equal numbers? Or does it work better for the babyfaces to maybe be badasses who don't just feel the need to even the odds? They're willing to fight at a disadvantage.
I don't think it needs to be even. I think it needs to be close, but it doesn't need to be even, because hopefully you're not in a position where you're doing the NWO style brawl every week. You know, I think it has to be close. You know, three guys feuding with eight guys is going to feel too lopsided, but if it's three against five, I don't know. I don't feel like that's a huge issue.
Yeah. All right, a different perspective here on JAS. JB in Jacksonville says, Wade and Mike, quick note to say how much I want the Jericho Appreciation Society to go away. The gimmick is a one-note joke that was clever for 5 minutes, but now it's just suffering through a meta groan-inducing WWE impression of a segment that made half of AEW's fan base stop watching Raw. Poor Daniel Garcia, fresh off a PWG Bowl of Win and looking like a no-frills future star, could have been in the Wheeler-Yuta position, but Jericho, quote, handpicked him to wear dumb hats and act like a clown in the JAS. 2.0 have no place on national television, those are fighting words, and are wildly annoying in a non-entertaining way. They remind me of one of those 1997 WCW Saturday Night Tag Teams that you knew would never make it to Nitro, you'd see against Frogman and Buddy Lee Parker. Ooh, I love these references from WCW Saturday Night in the 90s. This seems like Tony Khan giving Jericho too much rope. I think they think it's good heat, but for me, it's just bad for all parties involved. Fun show otherwise with a great opening match. Byron Buxton for MVP and go VIP. Boy, the end of that Twins game last night was insane. Oh, my God. I'm glad people are sticking in that. First place Twins do it again tonight. Mike, yeah, I mean, we've talked about JS and 2.0. If you want to add anything, you can. But we got another point of view out there, at least.
Yeah, like I said, I'm not opposed to people liking what they like.
Yep.
And hating what they hate.
yeah, definitely. It's not all about you, but he phrased it in a way that wasn't like, It's just my opinion, and that's all that counts. It was more like he's making the case. He thinks this isn't good for AEW. It's not good for Danny Garcia, and that 2.0. You know, it's a one-note joke that's played out already. I disagree with all of that, but it doesn't mean that I'm right. And part of it will be how do fans respond. But I like Jericho playing off new people. I've become a fan of 2.0, and I'm definitely a fan of Danny Garcia. And I don't think this is huge step back for Danny Garcia to be out there with Jericho, even if, I mean, he was a no-frills guy, and now he's a frills guy. But, I mean, I don't think that's a bad, by definition, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. All right, James in Clemson's up next. I am listening and would like to add a thought to the announcer conversation. I watched ROH for the first time over WrestleMania weekend this year, and I really liked the announce team for that show. I even made a comment to my friend about how much better they were than the AEW announce team. Okay, so, yeah, okay. Just was making a statement, so good to get that opinion. He says, I'm also kind of confused about the Samoa Joe versus Trent feud. What are we supposed to think of Trent? He outed Wheeler Yuta and looked like a total ass, yet he still hangs around with Orange Cassidy. There's also no chance he's getting cheered against Joe. Don't get me wrong, I enjoyed the show, but this feud seems like it didn't get very much thought at all. The video package on Dynamite just muddied the water even more for me. And one more thing, bring back Miro. That is all, James and Clemson. Yeah, I'm ready for Miro to come back too. I think that's a good point. I don't get Trent's character, and I don't get why we should like – I mean, I thought Chuck Taylor just felt like he was just not taking life or his job seriously in a way that I think, you know, was counterproductive. I know Tony Khan likes Chuck and Trent and respects them and trusts their judgment, and he puts them against wrestlers and asks for their feedback on them. I mean, it's just like he's a fan of theirs. So I'm not surprised they're trying to do something with them. But it is a – Trent's character is you know – I don't know if confusing or perplexing is the right word, because that would imply that fans care enough to have an emotional reaction to him. I just think it's sort of like blah. It's just like, okay, he's kind of a jerk to Wheeler and we like Wheeler, but he hangs out with Orange Cassidy. So can he be that bad? And we want to see Samoa Joe kick his ass, 'cause I care more about Joe than I do Trent. I don't think that's a great 1-2-3 punch for a character that has talent in the ring, and I think with better focus of the character could be a valuable part of the roster.
So it's Trent and Chuck kind of slide into the role that I think a few people have found themselves in. And I kind of talked about this earlier on, where 3 years ago when they were running those Bleacher Report specials and they were just starting out as a company, they were a big deal because they had come from ROH. They were a name value tag team. And now 3 years later, with the number of people that they've signed, whether it's Punk or Danielson and Moxley, so many of the others, their value on the roster has diminished. They're not as important as they were 3 years ago. And they're not the only ones in that position. I think a lot of people are in that position. So I think they, even in the tag team division at this point, should probably be an act you see on Dark, an act that can get over some new tag teams that you're trying to push up the card a little bit, because the teams that are kind of cemented in that division are all teams that should be ahead of them on the depth chart at this point.
Yep, I think that's a good assessment. All right, let's see. Ed in Hightower, California. I think we'll probably wrap up here. We've gone long here. Good evening, Wade and Mike. Kudos to Sheeta and Deeb. I thought that was the best women's match in AEW in at least 3 months. It didn't really have a great story or a ton of heat to it. But the match itself, I didn't notice missteps, seemed to be smooth, and they didn't get dumb or silly with the weapons. Do you agree with that, Mike? I mean, we talked about excessive, you know, stips and weapons and chairs and candlesticks and whatever. But, I mean, this was a feud that's been around a while. Some think it overstayed its welcome. But having a blow-off where it gets this intense and they kind of keep it, like you're using the weapons to win a match and inflict pain, not do creative spots to get a "this is awesome" chant. Do they get points for that? Did this work for you?
It worked for me. Yeah. Yeah. I think they kept it exactly what it was supposed to be. Like you said, it didn't get too out of hand. They weren't fishing for chants necessarily. I thought it fit. I thought it was fine.
I still don't really get Santana and Ortiz in the breakup of Jericho. They blame Jericho for holding them back, yet where are the title matches for them? Besides, what's holding up their pants? Where's the belts? It still seems that's what Jericho said at the beginning is true. It's them, not him. Yeah, you got to be careful, you know, about baby faces proving the heel right. You know what I mean? Like, you know, if a player, you know, says I need more, like an NBA player says, I need more time on the floor. I'm not a bench player. I'm a starter. And then he demands a trade, or in free agency goes to another team and he gets a lot of minutes and it doesn't work out because he can't play defense or, you know, whatever his shortcomings are that get exposed. It can, you know, okay, well, you were wrong. You don't want to book that on purpose for a babyface team. I don't think too many people are thinking about that. I don't think it's been long enough for that to be a huge issue, but I think it's something in the story arc of Santana and Ortiz that Tony Khan should keep in mind, because I think it's a good point. I just think it's a little premature, because I think Santana and Ortiz have a right to kind of settle the score with Jericho before they get focused on titles.
I would agree. Yeah, I think they can get focused on the title. And I think they should be involved in the title picture at some point. I think they're really good. And honestly, they've probably been underutilized to a certain extent since they've been in AEW. I think they would fit in fine at the top of that tag division with any one of those teams, from what I've seen throughout their run and Impact, for example. But yeah, I think right now they've got the personal feud that is rightfully so taking them away from the title picture, and they can always move into the title picture when this more personal feud with Jericho is over.
All right. Then he says, and apparently Eddie Santana and Ortiz murdered someone. You mentioned often about Scott Hall saying don't overdo the promo about how you beat your opponent, kill them, rip them apart, etc. Does Kingston's line to you fall within that category? I think if anyone can deliver that line about what it means on the street when you say you put a hit on someone, it means you got to, what was it, dig a grave or, you know, whatever it was.
Yeah.
I want to be careful that I don't seem hypocritical because I am a champion of that Scott Hall quote. And by the way, I'm putting up for the first time in a very long time the audio of that major Scott Hall interview from over 15 years ago that I did, like the 7-hour interview with him. We just put up the second part a couple days ago of that, and we'll have a couple more parts up. There's hours and hours of just Scott Hall at his revealing why he was so well respected as a really smart wrestling mind, but also personality wise, why he just didn't play, you know, politics well enough to ever have the influence that he could have had. So go VIP to hear that, everybody. If you want to hear it, it's worth signing up for a month just for that. I will say with confidence. I'm okay with it because it totally fits Eddie's character. It's like, I don't like when Samoa Joe's like, I'm going to kill you, frothing at the mouth. I didn't like in TNA when Joe was yelling and frothing at the mouth constantly, and I'm going to kill you. Even though it was sort of a catchphrase, you know, a chant for the fans. I totally believe with Scott Hall, because Scott Hall, and the way he said it is, you know, you got to hear the inflection. But it's like, you're not going to kill anyone. You know, why would a babyface say something that everybody knows he's not going to do? And now, what does pinning someone mean? If you've set the bar that I'm going to kill you, and nobody believes you, so you're not accomplishing anything by saying it. No one's like, oh, now I'm going to watch this match. He's going to kill him. And then you pin him. And it's like, we're supposed to cheer that? You said you're going to kill him. Now he's walking out of the ring. Like, it's just a dumb thing to say. With Kingston, it's like, oh, you got a hit on me? I want to scare the blank out of you by letting you know what that means in my world. I think that's totally fine. Mike.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, Kingston's believable with it, too. Like, it seems like he kind of comes from that back. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's a certain believability in the way that he delivers himself. Where I'm like, yeah, you know what? If there is someone on the roster who's going to kill somebody, it might be Eddie Kingston.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there was an Impact storyline like 5 years ago that where somebody got hit by a car, and I think Kingston was behind it. Little Richie was a kid. They killed a kid of all things in Impact. I think a few years ago, which was wild.
Was that when we got that the view through the eyes of the victim?
We somehow were zapped into his soul, I think, and we were able to look out of his eyes.
So like that's tied. That's tied with like 20 other things for the dumbest thing ever on a wrestling show.
Yeah. And you know, in the last 5 years of Impact has had quite a few of those. They've been better lately.
They've been better lately.
I've joked about it.
Yes. But and I mean, I get, you know, when you're trying to make, when you're trying to like stand out and be noticed, you know, and you're going to try some different things. And you're in a realm, you're in an era where Lucha Underground is kind of breaking some rules and, you know, it's just like, okay, you know, I'll give them a little more license, even if I roll my eyes and make fun of them for some of it, I'm less hard on them than when a wrestling company that has a big following and an established narrative structure and a certain rules of engagement and how shows are produced. And then you just like do something like that. Like it's just jarring and just low IQ dribble, stupid, dumb. So,
And that was also in an era too, where like everything was cinematic. Like cinematic matches were happening every, like everything was like that. So it was a little different, but as far as Kingston delivering that line, I mean, again, it feels believable coming from him in a way. So I didn't mind it. I didn't think it was on the line.
I'm glad we're out of the cinematic era. I wasn't hugely against it, but I feel like it could have gotten out of hand.
Yeah, and I think it was overdone. I mean, we got to the point where I was like, all right, I'm done. The first couple were new and definitely kind of cool. And then Andrew and I actually just talked about this last night. But we got to a point where it was like, oh, enough already. Like, I've seen enough of this.
Yeah. All right, and a couple other things here Ed's email. MJF and Wardlow is a replay of MJF's five labors. Is Archer a big deal? Who has he beat? Who has he destroyed? A lot of adjectives for Archer, but they don't ring true. The good thing here is Wardlow crushing MJF helps overcome the five labors redo. Yeah, I mean, that's been the criticism of this. It's a bit of a five labors redo. But I mean, it's not specifically calling on that, and it feels logical that, you know, I can't keep him out of the building because security isn't strong enough. So now I'm going to use my control over him to try to humiliate him, embarrass him, and hire a variety of thugs to try to weaken him so that, you know, he gets the picture. And of course we see MJF as delusional, knowing Wardlow's going to plow through everybody he brings up, but MJF doesn't know that. And we delight in seeing him and Sean Spears, you know, unravel when their plan doesn't work. I think that works. Mike, how about you?
Yeah, I think it works. I think it works too. And you know what? It is a kind of a recycled thing of the five labors of Jericho a little bit, but it also fits the MJF character. I mean, he's still the same guy he was when he fought Jericho, and that hasn't changed, and his personality hasn't changed. Like, I think it's been fine. I think it's been good. And I think like I said earlier too, I think it's highlighted Wardlow in a way that I didn't expect and has made me see more in him than I did 6 months ago, for sure.
And finally, he says, this probably makes me a bit of a jerk to some, but the Owen Hart stuff seemed to be a bit overdone. Felt somewhat cringy. It feels awkward that a wrestling company that is 3 years old is latching on this much to a wrestler who passed away 20 years ago. Maybe one or two wrestlers on the roster have an actual connection to him. I get honoring him. He was a wrestler, even if never in AEW. But what is being said just feels a bit too much. I think there's a better way to sell this and sell Owen and why they're having the tournament. The testimonies from wrestlers just don't feel authentic, whether they are or aren't. We aren't at the tournament yet, so maybe my feelings are a bit premature. Thanks for all the hard work and all the content. Top to bottom, the VIP content is fun, thoughtful, and helps tame the maturations of a wandering mind. In other words, go VIP. Thank you, Ed, very much. I'm not going to pass judgment on Ed being a jerk if he says someone might see him that way. But Mike, I mean, I think it's something to be careful about. I think this is sort of part of AEW's brand is cleansing the wrestling community of shortcomings in WWE's character as a corporation. And this is part of that. I don't find it exploitative because Martha's for it. And I've been fine with it so far, but I get what Ed is saying. I just am rebutting it because I think the context is important that AEW really is trying to be a better company and show it, not just tell us, but show us. And I think that it's true that for Martha, this is important that Owen's name can live on. And she wanted to live on, but she didn't want it to live on and have WWE make money off its name. That was important to her. It took a while. Sorry, AEW took 20 years to form, but if this is what Martha wants and Owen deserves it, just because it was 20 years ago isn't because AEW delayed doing it. It's that there's finally a place where it makes sense to do it. So I guess that's my rebuttal to Ed's perspective.
I feel the same way. I mean, I think it ultimately comes down to what's the family's opinion. And if his wife is okay with it and his family's okay with it, then, you know, I'm certainly in no position to say you shouldn't do this or it feels out of place. I mean, it would be one thing, and this is not the case here. I mean, if they were doing this on their own and the Hart family and Martha still disapproved, but they were doing it anyway, then it would feel like, okay, you're trying to earn money off of a tragic incident in wrestling history, and that would seem kind of
right. Oh, totally.
You know, scummish. You know, for sure. But yeah, no. In this case, with the complete and full backing of the family, like, you know, if they're okay with it, I'm okay with it.
Also, when the tournament starts, I would like to see a video package explaining from the genesis what Owen Hart really meant to pro wrestling. I mean, He was breakout standout North American-based wrestler. And there is a story to tell about what he was doing in Calgary early in his career. Just the amazing athleticism, the gift that he had, the passion that he had. We got glimpses of it in WWE, in the time near his death. But it wasn't the same as that rookie of the year and the guy who everybody on the tape trading market back then was just going nuts for. And it's just important to point out, like, it isn't just that because he died that they're paying tribute to him. Like, this isn't some patronizing, you know, pat on the head to a tragedy, and we're blowing out of proportion who he was and what he meant. He was a hugely influential wrestler in his time prior to going to WWE because of what he was doing in Calgary Stampede and the types of matches he was having with Makan Singh and the innovation and the moves and the grace. It was otherworldly for its time. And I don't think everybody knows that. And AEW shouldn't assume people know that. And they should tell that story in a very mini documentary type sense with the access that they have to whatever footage Martha can provide that they have rights to. Because there's a own story to tell that isn't just Blue Blazer, Brett's brother, and he died tragically, and it's sad. That's the last part of his career. It's not why he was a big deal, though.
And that's where having someone like Jim Ross on your roster can really help. I mean, if you wanted someone to narrate like a 5 to 7 minute video package on that whole story you just detailed, like Jim Ross is the perfect guy for that. And he knew him. Like, on top of that, he knew him personally. So, 100%. I mean, he was doing things early on in his career that people had not seen before. I mean, it's a style now that people would look at and go, oh, geez, everybody wrestles this way. But the type of athletic stuff that he was doing at that point in time was completely – the way we talked about the crazy high spots in the ladder match at the very, very beginning of this show, people would be talking about Owen Hart that way in, you know, the late 80s, going, you can't believe this guy's flying off the top rope, doing these things like, you know, missile drop kicks and everything else, just stuff that you didn't see a lot of.
When in the mid to late 80s, Dave Meltzer was hired by a national newspaper syndicator to do wrestling rankings, worldwide rankings of wrestlers. And it was an alternative to Pro Wrestling Illustrated and some of the other magazines that had their rankings lists. And instead of it being sort of kayfabe storyline, it was Dave's impression of who the best wrestlers were. And it was carried in tons of newspapers. In the small print, when they used to have a big section of the newspaper that had all the box scores for the baseball games and the scores for local sporting events. And it was just, you know, that's how people found out who won, not because of Twitter or text alerts or websites. And he ranked in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, Owen Hart number one ahead of Ric Flair. And that helped raise Owen Hart's profile because people are like, who the F is this guy I've never heard of who this national newspaper ranking system is saying is better than Ric Flair and the others who were in, you know, and Dave was ranking the top work rates, the people having the best matches. Now, you could say it was premature, or you can say, you know, the criteria wasn't laid out and it's open to criticism, whatever. I mean, you can say that, you can agree with it or not think any of that criticism is valid. But I know there was, you know, some people kind of raising eyebrows, you know, what has he done to deserve that and what's a criteria? Owen Hart was amazing, and that helped raise the profile. And that's part of the Owen Hart story is people around the country were reading about this guy who was ranked number one who they never heard of, and they thought they knew wrestling because they were watching all the syndicated shows in the mid to late 80s that you could watch during the boom period of syndication. It was like, you know, you had to watch when it was on or tape it on the VHS tape. It wasn't like YouTube where you could just search and watch on demand. But you could watch Memphis Wrestling, Mid-South Wrestling, Crockett Promotions, WWF syndicated shows, Continental Championship Wrestling, World Class Championship Wrestling, on and on, in wrestling blocks in different regions of the country. And you still could have not seen Owen Hart, you know, because he was in Calgary in Japan. And I took over those rankings at a later time in the early 90s. And, you know, it was fun to do, you know, and just kind of take a worldwide perspective on, you know, putting out there who the best workers are based on having, you know, keeping track of everything going on. But at that time, you know, that's how Owen became a household name in a lot of households. So again, I bring that up as an example of the rich story that can be told about Owen that goes beyond WWE-centric documentaries. And I hope they tell that story and don't just assume everybody knows. There's some fun stuff that can be talked about. I know Brett just kind of got signed back to WWE, and that takes him away from, you know, being a narrator on this. But frankly, that's probably – I should say frankly, that's better because that's not true. But I would say frankly, I think there's plenty of other people to tell the Owen story. And Brett, in a way, might – the reason I kind of said it might be better is because I think in a way Brett might book unintentionally Bigfoot Owen a little bit because he was the bigger star. And you might want it to be about Owen. And so let other people tell the Owen story.
Yeah, well, it's funny because you say, like, not everybody knows that story. I never knew that. That story about him having that number one ranking, and that's how a lot of people discovered him, or just were going out of their way to try to discover him. I wasn't aware. I mean, I knew of the career he had in Calgary and in Japan, but never knew that story about him. That's really, really cool. Yeah, I think they, meaning AEW, sometimes assumes that the viewer knows too much. We've seen that in the way that they've debuted talent at times, and they just start talking about the guy, and you're like, Andrew and I were talking about it a week or two ago, or last week, I think, with Satnam Singh. We were like, are we supposed to, oh yeah, I guess he was on TV once, but I didn't even remember that. I'm like, are we supposed to know who this guy is? Tony kind of explained it, but sometimes they just assume that you remember, assume that you know. This is a perfect example of just because Owen Hart had a Hall of Fame worthy career does not mean that everybody knows the whole story. So this is a good opportunity to educate. And there's probably a significant portion of their fan base, at least on the younger end, that I guarantee you would have no idea. So, yeah, this is a good opportunity to educate your viewers on the guy you've named this tournament after.
Yeah. All right, cool. Fun note to end on. Mike, I shouldn't say we're going to end on that note and then throw to you if there's anything else you want to bring up because that puts pressure on you. But is there anything we did not bring up that jumps out to you in the randomness of our calls and emails?
No, I don't think so. Actually, there was one thing that I wanted to get your opinion on because Andrew and I were talking about this this past week and 2 weeks ago. And realizing that Punk and Paige are probably going to be the main event at Double or Nothing, and now we know that they are. I wonder, and especially we were talking about this last night for the show that dropped earlier today, about whether the setup for Forbidden Door and the fact that it's coming foreshadows Punk winning the title. Because we were talking about whether the Hangman Page as the world champion. Maybe that was the original plan, and it was. Tony said it was the original plan. You know, you had that list of guys who's going to go from this guy to this guy to this guy back when the company first started. But again, given that their roster has evolved over these last few years and the number of other talent they've been able to sign, whether it's Moxley and Punk and Danielson, you know, it almost feels like Hangman, he's the world champion, but he's like the fifth or sixth biggest star on the show. And now that you're going into a pay-per-view against another company, like if you're going to do, and I don't know what the plans are for Forbidden Door, but if you're going to do some type of championship match, and what we discussed last night was if you're going to do a champion versus champion match, let's say they're going to do Okada against either Punk or Paige, which one's bigger? Like, it's almost certainly Punk and Okada. Is that pay-per-view foreshadowing a potential title change at Double or Nothing? I don't know if it is or it isn't, but it feels like it might be. I don't know.
I think it's an interesting and pertinent discussion point. I don't think the difference between Hangman defending or face, I shouldn't even say defend, facing New Japan's champion or defending against someone from New Japan is enough of a drop-off from what Punk could be involved in that doesn't involve a title that you should change your AEW booking based on that. Mm-hmm. I think Forbidden Door is going to be a novelty and it's going to be huge if they want it to be huge in terms of the match that they present. And whether Punk has a title or Hangman has a title and the other is in a different match, I think they both can be involved in a big match. And I don't think the show is ultimately going to be about the championship. It's going to be about the novelty of a dual show between probably what would qualify as on more ardent wrestling fans lists as their number one and number two favorite companies. And so I don't think who the champion is matters, and I think Hangman can have a really good match. And frankly, I could see it going the other way, that Tony goes, you know, Hangman's missing something. There's just that gravitas isn't there. He doesn't have the background of Punk as that level of a star, or Jericho or Moxley. So this is going to help elevate him. We're going to put him in a position where we think he can shine. It won't look like a big letdown where people are walking out of the building for his match if it goes on last, and it can help elevate his star. So let's actually keep the title on him longer for that purpose, whereas Punk is as big of a star as he's going to get. So I can play devil's advocate even to that view.
Yeah, that's a good point. That is a good point. You know, that does make sense that, you know, Punk doesn't necessarily need it for sure, because you know, you put the belt on Punk, it's not going to suddenly make Punk a bigger star. He is as big as he's going to get, and he's probably going to stay that way too. He's bulletproof, really, in a way, no matter whether or not he has the belt.
But if they want Punk to have the belt, regardless of Forbidden Door, they should have Punk have the belt. I don't think it's important enough for Hangman to get a boost to keep him champion longer than you planned either. I think it can work either way. All right, cool. I think the only match we're going to talk about is Undisputed Elite getting a kind of a quick squash win. But, you know, that was fine, and they put on their T-shirts, and they're going to sell some merch. yeah, so anyway, cool. Mike, this has been fun. Thanks to our callers and emails, and thanks, Mike.
Thank you for having me.
Yep. All right, don't forget, check out our Saturday SmackDown post-show. That's going to be fun. It's going to be a little different off the beaten path for us, but I think it's going to be a blast. I'm looking forward to hearing that. So remember, we won't do the live stream on Friday night, but you can send in emails for the show after SmackDown, and then we'll be back to the regular format next Monday, Wednesday, and Friday next week.